the Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. We have two members who are absent this morning. Representative Gelser is ill, and Representative Olson has a funeral he is attending this morning. Why don't you move on down this way?
Okay.
You want to sit down, way down here in the contaminated zone?
Did you meet me too?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's really exciting.
This is going to be an informational hearing, and I'm going to ask Representative Jean Cowan to report on the Subcommittee on Seniors and People with Disabilities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are moving forward, working on draft language right now around a bill that will be presented through the Senate Committee on Seniors and People with Disability, jointly with the work that our subcommittee is doing. They had a spot for a bill, and we had several in this committee, so that seems like an appropriate place to work through it. It is the language that I have worked very closely with Senator Morissette to draft, and the general concept is a little different than most of the bills we see in that so many are fairly narrowly defined and in sort of one little subject area, and this is more inclusive. We're still working on the language, but as a result of so many of the advocates coming together and being willing to talk about the whole issue of long-term care, we were able to develop quite an extensive list of items that we do need to take a look at in this arena as we see the growing demographic of aging individuals and the challenges of serving their needs in a community-based setting, but wanting to be careful about staying away from the language that sort of says we're going to keep people in their homes, period, because we need to recognize that as aging progresses, there are sometimes other residential needs that people face, and that includes the whole continuum from in-home care through assisted livings and adult foster care and into sometimes ultimately nursing home settings. But the challenge that we're seeing in Oregon right now, even though we have a very progressive system, and as I compare it to some other states, I'm beginning to understand just how progressive Oregon's system is. I recently visited Arizona and talked to some of their folks and decided we were doing quite well, but we don't want to lose that. And it's beginning to crumble. First of all, the priority that the committee agreed to was that we are losing some capacity in that mid-level range of assisted living facilities and adult foster care because of some of the corporate decisions to not accept Medicaid clients. And what that can do to the state budget then is to force people into nursing homes prematurely at a much higher cost. So we are looking at ways to adjust the state Medicaid rates for assisted living and adult foster care as probably the priority issue, perhaps within the Department of Human Services budget and perhaps with some additional funding. We don't know how that's going to sort of fall out yet, but that is a piece of it. In addition, the bill includes a directive or reminder or encouragement with the Department of Human Services to come back to us with some of the planning that they are currently doing and some vision of what it will take to make adjustments in other areas, and then sort of all of the rest of the priority issues that the group identified are included in the bill so that we will see direction going into the 09 session to address other areas from Oregon Project Independence to equities for the local area agencies on aging to bolster our in-home care and community-based care looking at whether our current eligibility standards are appropriate, perhaps taking another look at general assistance and the medically needy program, prescription assistance, the volunteer-based services, senior companions, RSVP, and that list of things. And I don't want to miss something, and I'm not trying to be all-inclusive, but I think it certainly includes Oregon Project Independence, but doesn't set it out as the only item. And I think it will lead us into a solid continuing conversation about these issues as we move into 09 and beyond. So I'm kind of excited about it. I know it's a little unique, and I'll probably have to do a lot of selling on it. But I appreciate Representative Maurer, Representative Gelzer's work with the Senate members, and as well as all of the advocacy community who have been there at the table all the way through and are excited about moving this forward.
Thank you, Representative.
You're
Representative
welcome.
Maurer, do you have anything to add to this?
No, not to this. I was just thinking, though, that this room is warm. The last committee we had, it was freezing.
It was.
This room is very warm.
No.
The sweater's good.
The only thing I will add is that we need to make sure that we're looking at what the state is doing from a regulatory standpoint is not creating artificial hurdles in the supply side. Available rooms, because a lot of this is a supply and demand, and if they can fill the beds with private pay, because you know there's such a dearth of available rooms and a lot of people, then it makes sense from a business standpoint. You know, you go where the money is. But if you have, and part of that's been because the state has put up artificial hurdles, so. We don't want to leave that.
No, the existing moratorium is definitely going to be part of the conversation. And we have a rapidly growing demographic that we need to help the market address and mm-hmm. to particularly be fair and equitable to individuals that placement meets their needs appropriately, and that we don't artificially move people beyond what their needs require at any particular point. That's the goal.
Thank you so much. Thank you both, and for Representative Gelzer also for spending so much time on this.
Representative Collins, I mean, she's driven the train, and we
appreciate
that.
That's great.
That.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gilliam, I know this is a special issue for you. Do you have anything to add to this or any questions to ask?
I have one question, particularly for Representative Cowell. Nobody, I think, has helped me in my rookie season here focus on particularly seniors and disabled issues, too, but senior issues more than Representative Cowan has. So I am very happy that obviously you put her on this, and that I'm happy for this report. So I appreciate it very much.
Thanks.
Most of the things that Representative Maurer tells me I'm confused by, but Representative Cowan, I'm disappointed that we're not taking this up. And I don't want to...
Meaning this committee.
Yeah, and I don't want to get into political discussion about this wacky session we're heading into. But I am interested in a little more about why, and if we found an opportunity, I'm not knocking it, but why we're heading to rules, and what your, a little more about what your thoughts are about our success in February by going that route.
The goal primarily was to address this issue jointly with our Senate colleagues, and so from the beginning, our subcommittee has been meeting jointly with the Senate Committee on Senior and People with Disabilities. We don't have on the House side a separate committee to deal only with that, and the Human Services Committee has such a vast array of issues to deal with that there were, I know, several items that the chair has been juggling to figure out what the bill coming out of this committee. Conveniently, however, there was a committee solely dedicated to this issue on the Senate side, so I just joined arms with Senator Morissette, and we have moved this absolutely jointly the whole way. I have been just as active as he in this process, and the committee has encompassed testimony from all across the spectrum. So it's a logical vehicle to put the bill in on that side, but it will, of course, come to the House for continued discussion. And the good senators know that I will be right there making sure that that bill moves as well.
Thank you.
The last thing I'd say, Madam Chair, is despite the constrictions of this session and your role here, I appreciate very much you continuing to put these issues with the materials that you have surfaced, because, again, of all, I think we can be proud of a lot of things we did as a body in that last session, but I believe that one woefully lacking area was our ability to be helpful to the seniors and disabled community. So full speed ahead, and if I can be helpful in that session or the one beyond, I certainly want to.
We will count on that, Representative.
Representative Gotin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. I'm glad to hear that general assistance is in the discussion for 2009, and I just wanted to point out today's front page article in the Oregonian about the length of time it's taking for folks to have their disability benefits approved by the federal government and the length of time it's taking. So it's clearly an issue we have to deal with in 2009. So
thank you for pointing that out. Astounding. Okay, we're going to move on. We're going to be spending some time on obesity prevention this morning, and then also the 211 telephone referral line. We're going to be spending the bulk of our time this morning on the siting and operation of Psychiatric Security Review Board and community facilities this morning. So just for your information. So, Dr. Malcolm, we're going to be opening up. Do I need to do this every time? Okay. A comprehensive approach to obesity prevention. Dr. Malcolm, Chris, is it Cabell?
Cable.
Thank you. And Lori Freiger?
Trieger.
Boy, that is
real today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And thank you very much for inviting us to speak today. With me, I have Chris Cable representing the Northwest Health Foundation, and Lori Trieger, who's the executive director of a community coalition that's working on many of the issues we're going to talk about. And they'll be speaking in just a couple of minutes. I think it's very appropriate that I'm speaking after the discussion that you just had, because, of course, one of the major drivers of the need for long-term care is the prevalence of chronic diseases in our population. So if we can do some things upstream in the long run, that's going to really make our system much better and make the lives of our seniors much better. Originally, I know you all should have gotten one of these books. This was going to be the focus of our presentation this morning, but as I got thinking about this more and talking about this more with you all, it seemed to me that I want to talk a little bit about this report that we've just issued and then segue into something that's related to this, and that's one of the recommendations that was in our childhood obesity prevention study in a little bit. So this is the third edition of Keeping Oregonians Healthy. This is that we put out. And this is kind of a data book in many ways. There's some really good information about the prevalence of various kinds of chronic conditions. And then we move upstream to talk about the underlying risk factors, specifically tobacco use, physical activity, and healthy nutrition. And there's some really good data in there as well. On those risk factors here in Oregon. And we also talk about in here those risk factors and those diseases in various populations of interest. There is a chapter on older Oregonians as well. So I recommend this to you. If you have comments or questions later during the discussion, I'll be happy to try to answer those. But one of the things that's clear when you look at all of these chronic diseases is the fact that probably the biggest emerging public health problem that we face is this problem of obesity. Tobacco use still kills more Oregonians, 18 a day here in our state, but obesity is something that's crept up on us and continues to creep up on us. So something that really is very, very concerning. And, of course, the issues in children mean that this is kind of a time bomb. You know, we all hear these metaphors about the pig and the python kind of thing. This is something that, as these kids get older, is going to be more and more of a problem. As you remember, I believe I presented to this committee about this study under the auspices of the Health Policy Commission. We were asked to pull together a set of recommendations about best practices in this area and what we could do as a state. There are 20 recommendations in here about different actions that we could take. And specifically, there are three that were at the top. And I'm going to switch to my PowerPoint here. So this is the report. I didn't bring copies of this today, by the way, but if anybody would like additional copies, we certainly can get those to you. So there were three top recommendations that the committee of experts kind of pulled out. And the first one was to establish minimum standards for food sold in schools. As you remember from last session, we've made some headway thanks to a lot of the good work that many of you did on this issue. The second recommendation that was in the top three was to establish minimum standards for physical education and to monitor the implementation of that. We made some headway in that. There's still more work to be done, and I know in the 2009 session, I imagine there's going to be a lot of discussion further about this issue. But the third recommendation that I want to talk about today was that we establish a statewide obesity prevention and education program. We call this OPEP for short. Now, this whole idea of a comprehensive program was based on our experience with tobacco prevention. And the basic idea is that if you need to change these kinds of behaviors, people have to hear the message about what they need to do and how they need to do it from a variety of sources around them. And I think about this kind of on a personal level in a way. If I was a smoker and I went to the doctor and the doctor said to me, you know, Mel, you really should stop smoking, well, of course, everybody listens immediately to exactly what the doctor tells them. But those few people who don't, you know, maybe I'd be scared for a little while, but the fact is that alone doesn't change a whole lot of behavior. But then I'm driving back to my office and I see the ad for tobacco prevention up on a billboard. I hear something on the radio about the availability of a quit line to help me quit smoking. I get to my office and they have a smoke-free workplace policy, so I have to go out in the rain and smoke. Then I go home and my wife says, you know, please go out on the porch. You're stinking up the house. My kids razz me because they've been learning about it in school. When you hear the message like that from all around you, we know that that really starts to drive behavior. So that's what we've done, I think, pretty successfully in the tobacco world. We still have work to do there, but we've made some real headway. But we need to do something similar in the obesity prevention world, in the promotion of physical activity and healthy nutrition. So what I'd like to do now, you all have in front of you the recommendation from this study. And what I want to do is kind of make a little more real for you what some of the pieces of a comprehensive program might look like. So the first item on the list there is a media public awareness campaign. This is an example of some of the counter-marketing that we've done with tobacco. You see Joe Chemo here. And we need to develop some similar kinds of messages around physical activity in a positive way, promoting physical activity and promoting healthy nutrition. I'm sorry Representative Gelzer isn't here today. This is the webpage of a community-based coalition in Benton County that's been very active and has done really some very, very good work. We at the state level have tried, with a little bit of federal funding that we have, to jumpstart the community coalition work. And you're going to hear a lot more from these two folks who have been terrific partners in that and really are doing some very impressive work. But we've had a conference once a year. We call it the Healthy Active Oregon Conference, where we pull together the local coalitions from around the state. They have to be multidisciplinary teams. They come, they learn about the issue, they learn about best practices. We try to inspire them, give them a chance to network and so forth. And that's the way that we've been able to try to jumpstart this, I think. Ideally, we would like to be able to fund all of these coalitions so that they can do more than what they're doing. And Chris is going to talk a little bit about a public-private partnership we've put in place that's gotten a little bit of funding there. But that's what really was very successful in the tobacco world, I think, is getting this work happening on the ground. And again, they will both talk in much more detail about that. Now, when you're working with communities, it's really important that you speak your community's language. And we know that not only do these different health problems occur in different amounts in different communities, but there's a tremendous amount of cultural freight that comes along with this. If you think about something like eating and food, I mean, what more culturally loaded thing is there? And so it's really important that the messages that we give out be crafted in a way that people can hear in those specific communities. And this, for example, is a poster from our tobacco program, obviously aimed at American Indians, who have a very high percentage of people who smoke. And again, giving the message in a way where the messenger is recognized and the message itself is one that will resonate with people is very, very important. So in our tobacco program, we were able to fund coalitions and groups in these communities to work on these issues and inform our work. Really, these are the folks who are best able to tell us how to do this right and in many cases to do this work as well. We'd love to do something like this in the physical activity and nutrition realm also. Schools are a very, very important piece of this. We know that kids spend a lot of time in schools. I think most of you are probably familiar with the school wellness policy issue. This is driven in part by federal legislation, which requires school wellness councils that have to have school wellness policies in place. Of course, there's a lot of latitude in terms of what those wellness policies actually look like, and it really depends on some activity on the ground to make those wellness policies have some teeth and advance these issues. So school-based coalitions, school-based activities is another facet of a comprehensive program that we would really love to be able to put in place. Item E that's mentioned on the page that you have talks about a media literacy curriculum related to marketing of food and beverages and promoting its use by schools. There's a tremendous amount of marketing that goes on to kids. Anybody who goes to the grocery store sees this sort of stuff. And of course, it's right at hand level for a young kid, typically. But one of the ways to deal with this is to try to teach kids how to respond to advertising that's aimed at them in a way that's a little bit more informed than what a young child typically would have. This is a great life skill, and there's some good research to back up this kind of media literacy training that it really can make a difference in terms of kids' consumption of these kinds of foods. Again, another part of a comprehensive program would include some efforts around media literacy. This slide was my attempt at talking about item H, a comprehensive worksite wellness program. This is, of course, what all of us look like every day at work, just fun and games all the time. Now, why, if we're talking about childhood obesity, would we have a worksite wellness program? I mean, there aren't too many kids who are at work. So why would we have something like this? Well, what we've learned from the tobacco world is that kids model the behavior that they see around them in their communities and among adults around them, and that activities that focus just on kids are not very effective. And so it's really important that our primary target is what's happening with kids, that we also have to address this larger issue. Again, there's good data to suggest that worksite wellness programs are very important in changing health behaviors among adults. We've been doing some work within state government and also trying to promote some activities out in the private sector as well. in a comprehensive program, we would greatly expand that and try to incentivize that in a variety of ways. And then I want to say a word about data and evaluation. This is a very, very important part of a comprehensive program. These are some data that we've used in our program to help inform our tobacco program. What this graph shows is the change in smoking among eighth grade students based on what kind of tobacco prevention program was in place in their schools. Now, on the very left, you can see the hatched bar is in 1999, and 2000 is showing the change after the program was implemented. And you can see among the non-funded schools, there was a small drop in the prevalence of smoking, but nothing terribly dramatic. We then looked at the extent of implementation of a tobacco prevention program in schools, and we grouped them into three groups: low implementation, medium, and high. So the high group had the most intensive, most credible program in place. And what you can see is that there's kind of a dose response, that as you increase the implementation of this program, you see a much greater response in terms of reduction of tobacco use in eighth graders. So this was something that I think we found very useful and reassuring, that the efforts that we had in place around these school programs were in fact having some effect when they were faithfully adopted and implemented in the schools. Very, very important part of having a comprehensive program is the ability to do this, to evaluate what you're doing and feed it back into your program so you're using your resources as effectively as possible. And then finally, I think in order to pull something like this off, you do need some organization to do it. You do need some statewide leadership and coordination. And that's something we have a little bit of the seeds of from our federal funding right now. But again, with a full-fledged comprehensive program, we'd have to run these various grant programs and so forth. We would need some infrastructure to do that. Now, at the core of this, of course, is a stable source of funding. For our tobacco program, it's been the Measure 44 funding primarily that was passed in 1996. We don't yet have an answer for what that source of funding might be for our obesity prevention initiatives, but that's a key piece of the puzzle here to make this comprehensive program happen. Well, with that, I'm going to stop and turn the microphone over to Chris.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak here today regarding comprehensive approaches to obesity prevention. My name is Chris Cable. I'm here representing the Northwest Health Foundation. Northwest Health Foundation was founded 10 years ago with a mission to support, promote, and enhance the health of the communities in Oregon and Southwest Washington. We achieve this mission by making grants to nonprofit organizations and local government agencies, by convening health experts and community members to learn about emerging community health priorities, by advocating for sound public policies that will advance community health, and by providing technical support, workshops, and education. Over the past 3 years, the prevention of child and adult obesity has been a top priority for the foundation. In 2006, we funded 7 community coalitions, one of which Dr. Cohn just mentioned, that are all dedicated to advancing policies and creating environments that make the healthy choice the easy choice. These coalitions are working on initiatives as diverse as establishing safe routes to schools, advocating for countywide trail systems, establishing farmers markets and school gardens in low-income communities, and incorporating health considerations into countywide planning policies. These coalitions were funded through our Alliance Promoting Physical Activity and Nutrition, or APAN program, which was a collaboration between Northwest Health Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, Care Oregon, and Pacific Source Health Plans. All of these coalitions that we funded represent the critical importance of our built-in social environments in shaping health behaviors. A convincing and growing body of research has established that while health education is important, education alone is not sufficient to drive substantial changes in population health behaviors. So this is especially true regarding eating and physical activity behaviors, which are often made with little conscious thought, which are shaped and enabled and reinforced by many factors in our built and social environments. Two recent comprehensive reports validate the socio-ecological approach to health promotion. Both of these reports represent about a year's worth of work among dozens of state and local health officials, university faculty, and community members. The first is the Oregon Health Policy Commission's Child Obesity Report, which Dr. Cohn just referenced. This report presents 20 recommendations which, if enacted, would dramatically improve healthy options for Oregon children and families. I'd like to thank the legislature for making progress on three of these policy recommendations, most notably House Bill 2650, which established stronger nutritional standards for food sold in schools. Due to this piece of legislation, Oregon jumped from having an F grade in statewide school nutrition policy to A-, as measured by the Center for Science and Public Interest. This is by far the greatest progress of any state in the nation on this report card. The second report is called A Healthy Active Oregon, the Statewide Physical Activity and Nutrition Plan. This report presents recommendations in six domains: the built environment, work sites, the healthcare system, schools and childcare settings, the broader community setting, and the home environment. I should note that in addition to our APAN grantees, we've also just announced our grants for our Kaiser Permanente Community Fund. And two of these grantees, EcoTrust and Thousand Friends of Oregon, are working to advance policies that are represented in both of these reports. While we've seen many of our grantees and community partners achieve impressive results in recent years, our capacity to fund community-driven initiatives in this area is relatively modest. We're not a huge foundation. But we can provide catalyst funding to jumpstart community efforts around the state. But to truly bring these efforts to scale, state support is necessary. I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to speak regarding comprehensive approaches to obesity prevention. I'd like to turn the microphone over to Lori Trieger, who directs one of our funded coalitions, the Lane Coalition for Healthy Active Youth.
Thank you, Chris. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much for having me here this morning, and excuse the frog in my throat. My name is Lori Trieger, and I am the Executive Director of ELCHE, the Lane Coalition for Healthy Active Youth in Eugene, Oregon. ELCHE is Lane County's Childhood Obesity Prevention Coalition, consisting of more than 170 concerned individuals, representing nearly three dozen Lane County programs, organizations, and agencies. This includes physicians, nurses, dietitians, school board members, teachers, district administrators, parenting support programs, Head Start of Lane County, City Library and Recreation Services, Oregon State, Lane County Extension Nutrition Educators, YMCA, University of Oregon faculty, the local food bank, the transit district, and many others. ELCHE continues to work diligently to involve and include new partners in our ongoing efforts. ELCHE serves as a convener and a connector for this diversity of stakeholders to identify and support programs and policies that will improve child health and well-being by creating access and opportunities for better nutrition and enhanced physical activity environments. Through education and outreach, we work to raise community awareness about the alarming rise of childhood obesity and related health consequences for our children, and to act on solutions. This is at times an overwhelming and sometimes daunting task to take on as a local coalition. I brought with me two brochures that were developed by ELCHE about a year and a half ago. These brochures were developed to be used primarily as a tool for pediatricians and other healthcare practitioners for them to hand out to families struggling with the issue. They offer simple steps that could be taken to improve nutritional intake and increase physical activity. One is designed for infants and toddlers, and the other for older children and teens. And I brought these just as an example of ELCHE's work and some of the kinds of things that could be produced on a larger scale with a statewide effort. ELCHE participants have also helped craft local school wellness policies, as was talked about earlier. We advocated for increased PE and improved nutrition standards in school last session. ELCHE participants serve on countless committees and advisory bodies and engage in projects to help realize our vision of Lane County as a community in which all youth lead healthy, active lives fueled by nutritious food. In 2005, LCHE conducted a BMI data collection study for Lane County children, included more than 10,000 students. 18% of those children were found to be in the at-risk for overweight range, and fully 19% were in the overweight range. With a national childhood obesity prevalence of 16% for 6 to 12-year-olds, our results demonstrate Lane County exceeds the national rate for childhood obesity. Before coming to LCHE, I worked for 7 years at the second largest food bank in Oregon, and I'm continually amazed at the similarities and the overlaps in doing this work with LCHE. Families living in poverty face many challenges with scarce resources to meet basic needs, access to affordable, healthful nutrition, and the necessary time. Storage and cooking facilities are often far beyond their means. When you add to this the fact that low-income families in Oregon are more likely to live in areas that, among other safety issues, do not have well-maintained outdoor play areas, it becomes clear why the risks for childhood overweight and obesity are even greater for this population. But I want to be clear that in no way am I suggesting this issue affects only those living in poverty. This childhood obesity epidemic is a public health issue for all of us. In closing, I want to share with you an experience that I had last week. I had the opportunity to spend 4 days at Head Start Region 10 training. Region 10 consists of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska. As you may know, Head Start is a federally funded program that provides preschoolers from low-income families with essential early childhood education and support. There were nearly 350 attendees at this conference, most of them classroom teachers and food service directors and so on for Head Starts around the region. About 75 of these attendees were from Oregon. The training was titled, I Am Moving, I Am Learning, a Proactive Approach for Addressing Childhood Obesity in Head Start Children. There were dynamic and creative methods and techniques shared with emphasis on good nutrition and developmentally appropriate physical activity. And I was especially impressed with the commitment of the attendees. They want so much to do what is right for these kids. Through careful planning and professional development, Head Start works hard to introduce concepts and provide parent support and education to create healthy families and get children ready to learn. And if from 9 a.m. to noon, children hear about the importance of healthy eating habits and they're encouraged to get up and dance and move and treat their bodies well, it's vitally important that when these children leave that classroom, the messages, the policies, and the practices of their community support the lessons that they've learned in that classroom. A comprehensive, coordinated childhood obesity prevention program in Oregon would go a long way toward ensuring this happens and would amplify the work of local coalitions such as LCHE. I thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you for your testimony, all three of you. Any questions of
how much time do we have for questions, Madam Chair?
We're ahead of schedule.
Yeah, we're ahead of schedule. So
thank you, Madam Chair. I have several questions. Hi, Lori. It's good to see you.
You too. Thank you.
The Head Start anecdote was interesting to me. So what would the local Head Start group need to make this happen? You know, they have a lot of mandates. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of things. You can always integrate curriculum.
Right.
What do you think would be helpful in terms of a resource issue? Obviously, supporting local coalitions works, but in terms of, is that an additional staff in the Head Start classrooms, additional materials? Trying to get a sense, because, you know, as we expand Head Start here in the state,
right,
it'd be nice to be able to include this additional education and prevention work, but what does it take? Are other states doing it? So it's kind of a multiple question.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kotek, thanks for the question. And I would hesitate to give too much of an answer. I'd rather have someone from Head Start to talk more about what, you know, specifically what Head Starts need, but I do know that funding has been steadily reduced for Head Start programs, and that the challenges that many of the sites, at least in Lane County, face are numerous and, again, just have to do with shrinking budgets and resources in general. They're in expansion mode in Lane County, added several spaces this year, and like you talked about, the expansion looking at early Head Start, but then there's constraints. Hear a lot about constraints about space for siting the new classrooms and having the developmentally appropriate playgrounds and so on. Those don't come cheap, to have play areas that are safe and appropriate for those kids. I think the biggest challenge that I heard in talking in the breakout groups at the conference was keeping the parents engaged and involved, and again, as Dr. Cohen talked about, to create that continuity so that what's happening in the classrooms, happening in the home, is happening in the community. And particularly for Head Start parents, they're just so busy and overwhelmed, and to have one more evening meeting to come to, or some kind of activity related to the child's preschool, is just beyond what they can manage. But I know that parent engagement, Head Start understands that is a critical piece to success, and one of the biggest challenges they face is getting parents engaged. Mm-hmm. I also know from what I observed and what I heard at the training, and it was brought up about worksite wellness policies, that a great challenge for many Head Starts is that their staff are struggling with these issues themselves. And so here we were at a training talking about getting up and not having kids sit longer than 20 minutes at a time, and having moderate to vigorous physical activity, and the teachers can't get up and engage and model that themselves for the kids because they're struggling with their weight as well. So I think there's, I don't know if I exactly answered your question, but I think there's a number of factors.
No, thank you. That's helpful. I'll follow up with the Head Start folks.
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Yes.
Another question? And this is to the entire panel. And though I will always be supportive of statewide coordination and idea of OPEP, I think, you know, as if we're going to take this on as a serious public health crisis, there has to be some coordination. I think local grants, local coalition work, absolutely essential. But I also would argue that the tobacco issue has also, there have been some big hammers at the policy level, lawsuits, you know, clean indoor air. I mean, there are a lot of things that are addressing this from the infrastructure systemic side of things. And there are a lot of recommendations here, in addition to the OPEP one, as we've passed school nutrition and PE, and we'll continue to work on those. I'd be curious to know which of the other recommendations that each of you would recommend from the policy side of things. Is it banning junk food marketing in the schools? Is it more the land use side of things? I'm just wondering, what's the next state policy thing we really need to take on full board, in addition to having more statewide coordination? Since I have you all here and I've got your recommendations in front of me, just kind of curious. Because as Chris was saying, it's education and prevention work.
Right.
You need that. But, you know, there. If we put it all on personal responsibility, we are ignoring the fact that there are structural things in our society that push this forward. So
that's the end of your comments.
Yeah.
Is it that time?
Not take that personally.
I don't know if you're...
There's an honor guard.
That could well be, okay. Yeah.
So you got a breather. Think about that.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek. I think, I guess there's a number of responses I would have to that. First is, those policy changes don't happen in a vacuum. And having a coordinated state program is one of the reasons, certainly not the only one, but an important reason why some of those policies got enacted at the state and local level. So I do think, again, the consensus of the planning group that wrote this report really was that the three top priorities were the ones that I enumerated for you. So I do think clearly in the physical education realm there's more work to be done. Beyond that, I guess if you had to ask my personal areas of great interest, the places where I see the biggest gaps, it's probably around the land use area. I think land use and community planning efforts are incredibly important in terms of determining what the environment looks like, that the environments that we live in. And in public health and the health community in general, I don't think we've done a terribly good job of engaging with the planning process. So what do we need in order to do that? Well, we need some mandate to do it, for one thing, because as we approach these processes, I mean, people look at us like, why are you here? We also need to equip ourselves to be able to do that. So we need to speak the language that planners speak and understand what the issues are. So there are some recommendations around land use planning that are in this report and also in the statewide plan. And I guess the other thing I would comment on, it was perfect that Lori chose the Head Start example to talk about. In the tobacco realm, we believe, based on the research, that the middle school years are really the critical years for us to target. I'm not sure we know what are the critical years around physical activity and nutrition, but I think there's a pretty good consensus. I don't know how much data it's based on, but there's a pretty good expert consensus that the early years are probably very important in terms of laying the foundation for these habits. And so I think some more focused efforts around what's happening in the childcare environments is probably very important. We do have a number of tools to do that. I mean, we do review and license childcare facilities, for example, and there's a precedent for state policy involvement around some of those issues. So I think those are the two areas that I would probably personally focus on. I don't know whether the others agree.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I'd really...
Do state your name again.
I'm sorry, Chris Cable, Northwest Health Foundation. And I'd like to echo Dr. Cohn's comments. When you look at the Oregon Health Policy Commission's Child Obesity Report, six of those 20 recommendations have to do with land use, community design, and zoning. And the way our built environments are designed exert a tremendous influence over, for example, whether or not we choose to walk or ride a bike, or whether or not there are healthy food choices available in our neighborhoods. And I'd like to applaud the legislature. Actually, one of these recommendations regarding the built environment was addressed in the 2007 session, and that had to do with school siting. The legislature voted to allow school districts to assess system development charges on new developments for the construction of new schools. Now, what does that have to do with child obesity, you may ask? Well, what has happened in Oregon and elsewhere is that without those system development charges in place, school districts had to keep building schools further and further away from where people actually live. That has led to a decrease in the amount of children who are able to walk and bike to school. About 40 years ago, almost half of American school children either walked or biked to school. Now it's about 11%. Now, that sort of daily physical activity that's built into the average activity of a child, while it doesn't occur within the formal context of any curriculum or any school activity, does contribute to the average caloric burn of a child. And that sort of just built-in daily physical activity, not only for children but for adults, has a tremendous amount to do with physical activity, nutrition, behaviors. Now, that is just one example. Others include encouraging counties and cities in their comprehensive planning documents to include health considerations, just like they include environmental considerations or things about air pollution, streams, etc., into their planning documents to ensure that their access to trails and parks, to ensure that there are healthy nutritional options available in neighborhoods, etc. So I'd like to echo Dr. Cohn's comments on that, and also to say that the child care environment is critically important. It's one that there's been a lot of energy and emphasis on the K-12 environment, and appropriately so. Up to this point, nutritional options and physical activity requirements in the child care environment hasn't really been looked at as closely, but there's some recommendations in both of these reports that get at that environment.
Thank you. Lori Trieger with LJ. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would just briefly add that rather than pulling out one particular recommendation, one of the values of the statewide work is that it does overlay, as you know, Oregon has communities of varying sizes, rural communities, urban communities, coastal, mountainous, and even within counties. In Lane County, we have all of those elements as well. And so when you have all these different pockets of populations, they're going to have different needs and different issues. So all of the things that were just mentioned before me around land use and development and planning are, in fact, issues in every community in Lane County, but to a different degree and with different particulars. And so having a sort of overarching plan and opportunity for people to come and bring those concerns and create a coordinated way of addressing them would be helpful.
And as far as particulars, I just think a huge value in it is, as was talked about in the first segment when Dr. Cohn presented, is having consistent messages that kids are hearing that can counteract all the other messages that they're getting around what kinds of foods to ingest and what those do or don't do for their bodies and their health. And I just think having a program whereby we have those consistent counter messages is just critical, because the saturation point has been reached and beyond.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you mentioned Planning Commission. I was on the Planning Commission in Milwaukee for 7 years, and I think planning issues are extremely important, and certainly siting of schools. And I think what we're seeing now is more closing of schools, neighborhood schools, and then children being bused to larger schools outside their neighborhood, which is counterproductive when we're trying to look at exercise for these children. I've got three different things. The other one is regarding news. The movie, was it Broadcast News, has been on, it's on video now, apparently available, and one of the things that they complained about in that movie, which is I think 20 or 25 years old, is that news has become entertainment. Mm-hmm. And so nowadays on the news, what we see is horrible things that happen. So when parents watch this, they're fearful that their child is going to be raped and murdered the next time the child goes outside the door. And actually what we know is statistically that crime has gone down, but that isn't the kind of news that parents are getting. So they're reluctant to let their children walk to school, which is, not sure how the legislature can counteract that. The third thing is development of buildings, even in our own building here. And I hope, I've mentioned that to several people. I'm hoping that this will change. That I used to put signs up, colored signs that says walking is good for your health, and you can go right around the corner and take the stairs up. The stairs were ugly and dirty and looked like maybe someone had urinated in recently. I don't think that had happened, but they were uninviting. And I think that's one of the things that we need to do, is make stairs inviting to walk on, that it will be a pleasant experience walking up the stairs rather than avoiding it because it's going to make you feel bad. So I hope we do more in terms of planning, and also in requiring builders, especially in public buildings, that they will have stairs that are inviting for people to use. And maybe we can work later when we do have the stairs in another year, that we can do something about signs that will invite people to walk up the stairs rather than take the elevator. Mel, you look like you want to say something.
Chair Tomei, that is actually an evidence-based practice, improving the stairway environments. There's data to suggest that you can get quite a bump in stairway use if you put some signage up to get people to use the stairs and make them more palatable places for people to go into. And it also is something that, particularly in the public building realm, that there's a lot that could be done on the policy level, I think, to address that small issue. Again, that's not going to solve the whole story, but it's a lot of little pieces like that that are going to make the difference.
Right. And we, you know, when you were talking about the personnel maybe you're working with Head Start, who have issues themselves about exercise and weight, then, you know, we need to help them. Maybe they don't have time to go to the gym. Many of them are overworked. So what can you do in just the living environment to help them to get more exercise? So that's my expounding. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think those are good suggestions, and my question has to do with the practical side, so I want to pick up on that. But before I do, I wanted to this question will be for Mr. Cabal. How do you say that?
Cable.
Thank you. Chris and I worked together at the OHSU Foundation, so I know he had to go through that every day, and I just thought I'd give him a little. In fact, Madam Chair, if you allow me, at this time of year, I always think of Chris, the holidays, and the parties, and the opportunity to dance. And I remember one time Chris and I were huddled in the corner at a OHSU function. Everyone else was dancing. And Chris had no idea that he spoke for me when someone came up and asked him to dance, and he said, "No, when I dance, I appear to have a head and neck injury." Okay, I was thinking of Chris.
I suppose I wasn't modeling physical activity behavior on that.
Please state your name before you speak.
I'm sorry.
But Madam Chair, if you will. What I wanted to say was this, Chris. I want you to talk a little bit about the more of the practical side, because for me, I'm not against forward-looking policy that includes land use. I am just perhaps not as hopeful as others about this state's ability to sort out our land use issues quickly. In Silverton, where my daughter is now attending high school, we got a lot of great programs academically in it, so this is not a knock on my school district, except the old model of physical education of competitive athletics and people standing around waiting for their turn to do something they could care less about versus movement. You know, you talk about practical, let's start walking to school. Well, let's start moving for 30 minutes and compete against yourself. That could be a myriad of exercises that are lifelong and not the classic softball throw and all of that. I wonder if you could say a little more about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, thank you. That's an excellent point. And the physical activity bill that was passed in the last legislative session actually gets right at that point, because you're dead on. The sort of quote-unquote traditional model of PE that emphasized competitive sports involved a lot of kids standing on the sidelines for most of the PE session, and a lot of kids selected out, self-selected out, if they felt that they weren't competitive in a particular sport, if they felt that they weren't an elite athlete. And the legislation specifically states, I believe, going off the top of my head, that at least 50% of all PE time needs to be dedicated to movement, and specifically regarded the development of lifelong physical activity skills. And that's a great step in the right direction. Where I believe we'll probably have additional discussion in 2009 is funding, because I believe that bill involved $850,000 worth of grants that were going to be made available to school districts to actually implement new curricula and train PE teachers and provide for equipment. And unfortunately, $850,000, when you're talking about I can't remember, is it 197 school districts we have in Oregon, doesn't go very far. And so that's probably another conversation that we would need to have, but I do want to applaud the legislature for taking that great first step in recognizing that the PE curriculum needs to have an emphasis on the development of lifelong skills and involvement of every child in some form of activity, not just those who feel that they can compete in elite sports.
Can we follow up to that, Madam Chair? Briefly. Say a little bit about leveraging on funding, not just for this, but when you look at what little money we did or didn't provide, but you're sitting at a private foundation. Did we call it a private foundation? Would you call it Northwest?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, yes, it is a private foundation.
What are the possibilities for leveraging money in partnerships like you've displayed here in terms of federal, private dollars, foundation dollars, in your opinion?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, we try to leverage every cent we can, quite frankly. We're nowhere near the top in terms of asset base in the state for in terms of private foundations. I think we're sitting somewhere at number 10. We always look for opportunities for our grantees and try to leverage funding. The APAN program, which funds LCHA's work and others, is a great example where it was not only our funding, but also Kaiser Permanente, Care Oregon, Pacific Source Health Plans, and we're talking to the other health plans about committing its funding to it as well, with the idea that, you know, trying to invest a little bit of money upstream, hopefully will save them a lot of money downstream. We also are in very tight conversations with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. You may have heard earlier this year, they announced they're going to commit $500 million over 10 years to the prevention of child obesity. We would very much like to see some of that money coming to Oregon. And I personally have been in touch with a lot of the members of their program staff, trying to get them excited about the work that Lori and others are doing out here in Oregon. And obviously they've got a lot deeper pockets than we do. And so if we can kind of get the ball rolling with the modest amounts of funding that we have, commit some national funding partners to this at work, and then also hopefully partner with the legislature and get some matching funding there as well, we can really make a dent in this problem and hopefully reverse the trends.
Every senator, I would like to remind you and Mr. Cable both that dancing is a great form of aerobic exercise, even when it's not fairly stereotyped. Thank you so much. Oh, were there any other questions? Quick questions. Okay. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We have Stephen Gutley and Ian Finch going to be talking with us about the 211 Health and Human Services telephone referral line. Hello.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Ian Finch is running late, but I hope that he will arrive by the time that I am done with my testimony. And I am going to put on my glasses. I'm not exactly going to read, but I do have notes, and without my glasses, I won't be able to see them, so I will do that. I'm handing out, first of all, I wanted to thank you for inviting Oregon 211 to come to the table today and update you on where we're at in terms of House Bill 3443, which we obviously know about very well. And we appreciate this opportunity to talk with you today. The written testimony that I distributed is mainly...
I'm sorry, could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to do that in a moment. I'm Stephen Gutley. And I will actually tell you where I'm from. Why don't I do that right away? And this must be Ian Finch.
Yes.
And I will introduce Ian when we are done. I'm Stephen Gutley, and I'm the board chair of the nonprofit Oregon 211. I'm currently the director of development for this Oregon and Southwest Washington affiliate of Susan G. Komen for the Cure, where I started on October 1st. I'm sure that you are all aware of what Susan G. Komen for the Cure does for Oregon in terms of breast cancer awareness. We also have a wonderful program where we provide free mammograms for the uninsured. So that probably will be something that I would like to come back to you about in the future. But I'm here today for Oregon 211. And the reason I got on the board was I was the Director of Planning and Development at the Oregon Child Care Resource and Referral Network, which I'm sure you're all aware of as well. And many of the board members have come from organizations that are involved with making Oregon 211 work and believe that it will be important for their nonprofit or for their agency. The testimony I gave you is mainly background information for you to give you an idea of the 211 system and why it's important. But I wanted to talk about a few other things that were not in the testimony that I believe are also important. And I believe the testimony is important in terms of both written and verbal to give you an idea of where we're at in terms of 211 in Oregon. Oregon 211 originally started as a loose confederation of information and referral providers, United Ways, other nonprofit organizations, and state agencies that first began meeting in the year 2000. While Washington State and Idaho have since implemented comprehensive 211 services, Oregon's statewide progress has been delayed due to a lack of centralized planning and coordination and a lack of funding. So a group of volunteers from the Confederation that began in 2000 have formed a nonprofit 501c3 called Oregon 211. Some of those board members are in the room today, and as I said, I am the current board chair of Oregon 211. So this leads us to House Bill 3443 and my brief update on where we are now. First, we have representation from the Office of Emergency Management on our board, because we know that in House Bill 3443, it's apparent that we need to work closely with them, and that any federal money will come through the Office of Emergency Management. Our board has worked to make Oregon 211 a viable nonprofit by focusing on private support. As you can see in the written testimony, we have recently received $70,000 in foundation funding and are pursuing other private support from the foundation and corporate sectors.
So, Gutley, I'm going to invite you lean back a little bit from this.
Sorry. There is a fully operational regional call center operating in Portland that serves a seven-county area, the Portland metropolitan area, and four counties in southwest Washington. It's interesting to note that one of their main funders is the state of Washington. Two other call centers are in planning stages, one in Eugene and one in Lane County, and representatives from Portland, Eugene, and Lane are on the Oregon 211 board. And we are trying to help them as much as possible to establish those 211s in Eugene and Lane and make the Portland 211 stronger. So where are we at? We have a viable nonprofit that is trying to keep the momentum going to establish a statewide 211 system in Oregon. We're using private funding to continue the planning and groundwork for such a system. But it will never really be established without a public-private partnership. Washington State has funded our partner WIN211, and the $4.5 million in state funding they have received over the past few years has helped them leverage $2 million in private funds. So we believe it will take both a state and federal commitment to see a 211 system grow in Oregon. But Oregon 211 is trying to prepare the state for this hoped-for influx of support by establishing the private partnership that will also be needed. I know Oregon has many competing goals and needs, but a viable statewide 211 system should be one of them. And I will answer questions, but I'd like to introduce Ian Finch, the Outreach Coordinator for the Homeless Families Coalition at the Portland Social Service Agency, Portland Impact. He would like to say a few words. I know we have a limited amount of time here, so I wanted to have Ian talk a little bit, and then we'll be ready for questions.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Hi. Thanks for letting me speak this morning. So I'm Ian. I'm Ian Finch, and I am a single father with five children, and I just want to speak on my experience with 211 because when I got laid off my job, I got an eviction notice because I couldn't pay my rent. And I really didn't know what to do because here I am supporting these five children and now I don't have a job. And sometime throughout my system working with Department of Human Services, someone told me, well, you're a man, you should just be able to go get a job and support your kids. And so when I was facing eviction, I didn't know what to do because I was embarrassed because I couldn't support my kids at that time. And I was scared because I didn't know what was going to happen to us. And so I picked up this card and it said, call 211 if you need social service help. So that's what I did. I called 211 and I told them my story, and not only did they tell me, you know, Ian, go to Portland Impact, but they told me who to talk to. And so I went there and I only had to tell my story once because I felt humiliated as a father. Here I am supposed to protect my children and be able to provide for them, and I couldn't. And they made me feel good, and they not only, because I was looking for my short-term fix of rental assistance, but they asked me, Ian, what are you going to do next month? I said, I don't know. And so not only did they go above what I was looking for, they got me into a transitional housing program, which was based on my income, and there I was able to go to school. I was able to get my children involved in homework club, which really helped them with their education, which I felt important. And I got to go advocate for other low-income individuals. And that's when I got my job at the Center for Family Success as a parent advocate and start helping and advocating for these other folks who were going through situations like mine. And last February, I got to go to Washington, D.C. and have a press conference for with Hillary Rodham Clinton and Senator Dole about the National 211 bill. And that was a really exciting time for me to be able to share my story kind of nationally about how 211 helped me kind of navigate the system for me with one phone call. It literally was one phone call, and I got the help I needed, and my children got the help I needed. And now I'm doing this homeless coalition thing for Portland Impact as part of my internship for my school, so I'll be able to graduate with a degree and also get experience while I'm helping other families kind of navigate the system that my family and I navigated. And so I've also used 211 for a simple thing like, I have five kids, I need daycare. So I call 211 and say, hey, this is my situation, I need to find daycare for my children. And they hooked me up with the resource and referral line, and my children are in good quality daycare today that I might not have had if I would have had to go to all the different daycare providers and get their numbers and interview them, because I'm working, I'm going to school, and I'm raising five kids alone. So I wouldn't have been able to do that, except I just make one phone call and I get the information that I need that's going to benefit my family and I. So thank you for letting me share today.
Thank you. It's very gratifying to hear when the system works. Thank you for telling your story.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep it brief. Ian, it's nice to see you again.
Nice to meet you.
You know, I've been following 211 since my days at the food bank. How much are other states putting into this? I actually am disappointed we're not further statewide.
Right, right.
And I think you are too.
Right.
What's the plan? We do need the private side, but right. There are other states who are investing significantly because there are parts of the state that really need this. And
right.
We talk about all other service systems, talking about information referral. I don't want to invest in another INR process if we can just have 211 statewide. So what's the plan in terms of what's the investment we need, I guess? What's the number?
Well, I think that you could take a cue from Washington State, which I said earlier. They've invested basically $4.5 million in state funding over the last 3 years. That's led to another $2 million in private funding. I truly believe that we could leverage more private funding if the state stepped forward. I know there are many other states that have made contributions, but 211 is really in its infancy in terms of there are many states that have supported it. Many of the states that have supported it, and we are doing this as well, are working for federal funding. There is interest at the federal level. Perhaps with a change in the election, something might happen, but I think federal funding is several years away. So I think that the real challenge here is, can the state of Oregon step forward with private funders and allow us to continue our planning and finding the people that are interested in making this happen statewide? We know that we'll need local funding as well. 211 Info in Portland is really funded with a combination of government and some private funding, but they're also very well supported by the United Way in Portland, which is part of the reason why they've had such success. And obviously they've also had such success because the state of Washington actually gave them money, because they're paying for the service in Vancouver. So I think, we could certainly bring back to the committee a list of what states are doing. We're working right now with a consultant named Tom Page, who has worked with several states, including the state of Washington, in terms of building this. But it won't happen without a public-private partnership. It just won't. I've been in fundraising for 26 years, and I know what private funding can do and what it can't do. Private funding can help us get this off the ground, but it can help us to really form the infrastructure we need to make it happen.
Thank you.
I really appreciate in your handout talking about the recent flooding in the States and mm-hmm. the wind damage
mm-hmm.
and how helpful this would have been if this had been operational in that
right.
area. So I hope that this is an issue that we'll be able to deal more with in 2009.
Right. And I think what we can do is certainly talk with you about what is the combination of private and government funding that would allow us to move forward. And I think there's a lot of possibilities as to what that would be. But we will still continue to pursue private funding for the coming year. And we have some very good possibilities. So hopefully we'll be in a better position to be able to sit down with you and say, well, we've got this amount in private funding. We think we can get this amount more. Here's what the government funding could do for us. I think this is a perfect example of a public-private partnership.
Good. And I hope that you will keep the committee in the loop. When you have information, send it to our committee staff who will disseminate it.
We will certainly do that.
Great. Thanks. Right. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Were there any other questions? Okay,
and I did want to thank Rick. I wanted to thank him for coming because he's came here on his own, and we really appreciated that. He obviously has done this before and did a much better job than I did, so I appreciate that.
You did a great job, both of you did. Thank you very much. I just want to reiterate that this is an informational hearing. It will not be a hearing where we take public testimony. We're going to be talking now about DHS, Department of Human Services, siting and operation of Psychiatric Review Board community facilities. And colleagues, I had asked staff to send on to you materials. What had happened is, you know, in my community in Milwaukee, there was going to be sited a facility that would have taken some of the Psychiatric Review Board patients and putting them as well as other patients that had come were coming from the state hospital into Milwaukee. There was an unfortunate response to that. And so what I'm hoping today is that we will get more information. This is not going to be a debate about whether or not these facilities should go in or where they should go in. This is going to be an informational meeting for us to hear from the professionals in this area and from also from some of the community members. But this will just be the first time that we will be dealing with this issue. This also came up, I know, in Representative Olson's district, and so it's unfortunate that he couldn't be here today. But in closing, we talked in the last session, in this previous the session that met earlier this year, about closing the state hospital. We know that has to happen. We also know that these patients need to be coming out into the community. And how this happens, we will have to have some responsibility in taking part in that. So, as I said, this is just an this is an informational hearing. So any question before we start hearing testimony? All right, thank you. Bob Nickel and Mary Claire Buckley. Thank you for coming today.
Morning.
You have a thrill? Bob, do you want to start?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mary Claire and I talked a minute ago, and with the chair's permission, we would ask if she could go first, and then I'll follow her.
Thank you. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And I appreciate the invitation to come to appear before this committee this morning to talk about some of the issues that have obviously come to the forefront recently in the board and its partners' attempt to move individuals whom the board has found appropriate and ready for conditional release into community placements. I have provided members, I believe, with a fact sheet about the board, and I think many of the members here are familiar with the board and its operations, but I would answer any questions you had with regard to the information on that fact sheet. But for purposes of today's hearing, I thought it would be most appropriate to focus directly on the conditional release process the rather comprehensive, I believe, and collaborative process that the board engages in making the determinations. And then, as Bob indicated, he'll talk about DHS's role in the development and funding of these placements for our clients. I will say from the outset that the board's primary purpose by statute is the protection of the public, and it takes that mission very seriously. As you know, is the agency that assumes jurisdiction over all persons who are found to be guilty except for insanity of a crime in Oregon who pose or could pose a substantial danger to others. The board's mission is to protect the public through the ongoing review of these individuals and to make a determination of their appropriate placement, be it in the state hospital on a forensic ward, in the community on a conditional release status, which is a highly supervised and structured program in the community, or ultimately whether they should be discharged from the board's jurisdiction. The board receives its clients from the courts. Currently, 75% of our clients are committed directly to the state hospital for care, custody, and treatment. And thereafter, it is the board's sole authority to determine what should happen to these individuals. They never return to the trial court. When they are sent to the state hospital, they are assessed and receive the care and treatment that is necessary for their particular situation, needs, and diagnosis. And after a period of time of treatment, and that can vary depending upon the individual's, you know, mental status and risk to the community, at the time that the hospital staff, the treatment team, the interdisciplinary team on the ward where the individual resides, believes that this person has completed the treatment program that has been designed for them and that they have maximized the benefit of the treatment at that hospital level of care, they will come to the board and ask that the board initiate conditional release planning. The first step of that, which I will say is a very comprehensive and collaborative process, it involves, as I said, the board, the hospital staff would ask the board first to order this evaluation. The evaluation entails sending a request to a community mental health agency, and in with that request goes the entire PSRB exhibit file. And the board is very adamant that anybody who considers assuming the care and treatment of our client in the community be aware of any fact that the board has about this individual. So we send the entire packet of exhibits to the community provider that's been determined, you know, through a process in the hospital, and with input from the patient, him or herself, about their choice and where they would like to go, with a consideration of what resources might best fit this individual's needs, they will ask for a particular agency to evaluate this person. That packet goes to the community provider that's been designated, and we ask the provider there to do a face-to-face interview, either at the hospital or the hospital staff transports them to that particular agency's office, and also to talk to the hospital staff and review the hospital chart if they so desire, because that obviously is a little more comprehensive than our exhibit file. And they make an independent assessment. Here the hospital has made a determination that they believe this individual is ready for conditional release, but the community is given the opportunity to make their own independent assessment whether they agree with the hospital that in fact this person is ready for conditional release and a return to the community. If the answer is no, that's the end of that discussion for that time. The board has never required or forced a community agency to take a PSRB client over their objection. If the answer, however, is yes, then they would write a report to the board. It would come back to our board. We would provide it to the state hospital staff. And at that point, the hospital would review it as well to make sure that the conditions that the community has outlined in that report and the level of care that they would sign off on that as well. And the client does in addition. So we have a summary of conditional release where all the parties involved agree to those conditions. That then is brought back to the board, and the board will either have a full face-to-face hearing if one is requested, or will review that request for conditional release administratively, and if they think it's appropriate, issue an order for conditional release, allowing this individual to move into a community placement. Most of those placements are initially to a supervised living situation, be it a residential treatment facility, a residential treatment home, or a foster home, for example, where there is staff available to our clients 24 hours a day. And the reason for that, you know, simply is, as you know, I mentioned, the board in making these decisions, the statute is clear that when the board makes any decision, their first concern must be public safety. And given that a number of our clients are in the hospital for a substantial period of time, they believe that it's best to transition people out in a slow and deliberate manner. And so they would go first to some place where they have that supports on a 24-hour basis, you know, where their medications can be monitored and things like that. And as they progress in a conditional release placement, they can step down to less restrictive alternatives. And so that's basically how that process works. I will tell you that currently the board has 743 clients under its jurisdiction, of which 373 are on conditional release in 22 counties throughout this state right now. Moreover, 98.7% of those individuals on conditional release remain on conditional release every month. And so clearly, I think that the efficacy of the board's decision and the ability of these individuals to live successfully in the community is evidenced by that fact.
Mary Claire, I'm going to stop there and ask a question because I've read this figure before. So does that mean that 1% go back to the hospital every month?
We, Chair Tomei, we average of the 373 on conditional release right now, we average 4.5 revocations a month. So four individuals would be about that 1%, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
And those, I should note also, are not necessarily for criminal activity. An individual can be revoked either for some violation of their conditional release order that is not a law violation, or because their mental health decompensates, often to no fault of their own. And the board intervenes in those situations so that we can take immediate action to stabilize them, and so that they don't get to the point where they may well commit another criminal offense.
Mary Claire, I'm going to stop you again.
Sure.
So what percentage of these four that go back to the hospital go back because of a crime they've committed?
Chair Tomei, less than 2%. We have been keeping that measure since 1995, and less than 2% of the four overall go back as a result of a commission of a felony offense, a new criminal offense.
Okay, thank you.
So, as you may also know, when the board was created just 30 years ago in January, the design of the system was that the board's budget would provide for the staffing and for the stipends for our board members, but the legislature left the funding for the care and treatment of our clients, both in the hospital and on conditional release, in the budget of the Department of Human Services. And so I would ask Bob to now explain to you how the conditional release development and funding works in our system.
Thank you. Let me ask the quick questions of Mary Claire before we go on. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Nickel. I'm the Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, and I'm responsible for the Addictions and Mental Health Division, which includes, as Mary Claire has indicated, the Oregon State Hospital. And the PSRV, I should just describe this, the planning, the monitoring, contracting for, development of, and not the operation of services in the community, but contracting with a variety of community services to provide the community safety, security, and treatment services. I think Mary Claire has done a great job of overall describing how the Psychiatric Security Review Board works. Ironically, I think given the concerns that do come up from time to time, it's actually a model of care and precision in monitoring how people are doing. We're getting more and more scientific and research-oriented in our risk assessments as we prepare people for a conversation with the Psychiatric Security Review Board. We don't necessarily expect that the PSRB agrees entirely with every detail of our risk assessment process, but we feel that we're getting closer to a common language, which really does help the decision go along a little bit more smoothly than it might otherwise. I'd like to, you know, emphasize the point that the history of community-based services in Oregon under the PSRB arrangements is one in which they're very safe and effective. And Mary Claire, again, has already described some of the details of that. The community facilities are well operated and do not threaten neighborhoods. In actual fact, when people begin to show any signs of difficulty, they're reviewed very carefully. And as we point out, 4.5 revocations a month come back. We work with those people back in the security and safety and the treatment environment of the state hospital, and when they're ready, we don't decide that they go back again. The Psychiatric Security Review Board makes that decision at that point. Mary Claire has already described that we have programs clients in 22 different counties. There are 44 community residential programs. Some of these are secure. There's only one complete secure facility that's only for PSRB clients, but the others are scattered out in other secure facilities. We have, I think, a total of 5 secure facilities now that house PSRB clients in the community. Often, again, as Mary Claire pointed out, the first placement will be in a supervised facility, not necessarily secure, but we look at that as a factor in whether we're comfortable. If they're not in a secure facility, they're almost always placed in a 24-hour supervised facility where their medications are carefully monitored every day. Every time they're supposed to take a medication, it's jotted down, noted. If they don't, that begins to be part of the area of concern that program would begin to take a very serious look at. I think the word on the street among PSRB people, and I actually have a few people who are friends of mine who used to be under the PSRB, I think the word on the street is it's a very tight system, probably tighter than just about any other system there is out there. I believe we provided you with a handout, and rather than to go through the entire sheet, I just want to add that two things. One is that my division is committed to protecting the legal rights as well as the neighborhood concerns that exist out there. And while it sometimes appears to be a difficult balancing act, I think the reality, the history of this speaks pretty well for itself. The pattern is that when we begin to develop a new PSRB facility, there is, and I understand, reasonable questions that get asked and concerns that we're really doing everything to make this a fair and safe situation for the neighborhood. The reality is that no patient is going to be released without the board's approval, by definition, people are not granted conditional releases by the board, nor do we bring them to the board unless we really believe that they're not a risk. We in my office are available to attend community meetings. We've done that before. I've been in a room with 400 people who were not happy with us around the siting, in this case not of PSRB facility, but another secure 16-bed facility. I'm pleased to tell you that you would probably never even know the facility is in the neighborhood. It's never made the news, to my knowledge. But we also understand neighborhood reactions. We're all neighbors, too. And we understand when these kinds of programs come in, not everybody's going to be familiar with how carefully we work on these. The second major thing I wanted to comment before I turned it over to other people or answered any questions is that my office is embarking on a 10-year plan to ensure a more equitable distribution of PSRB facilities, particularly residential facilities. That doesn't mean we're going to target small communities only. The reality is that most of our folks come from the larger communities. We're going to need to continue to develop facilities in Eugene and Salem and Medford and the Portland area, but we do need to find a way to make sure that there are that all counties and communities are doing their fair share here. We really believe, as I've mentioned several times in different ways, that these are not risks. but we'll continue to work with local communities that have been a little reluctant to help us with these kinds of projects. So I think with that said, I will stop for now, and if there are questions now or later, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Bob. Mayor Clay, if I'm doing my math correctly, one person a year returns to the state hospital because of a crime they've committed. Is that correct? Out of the 373 people, or fewer.
It was over a period of time. So there are years that we have none, but on an average, I would guess that would be.
And so how would that compare with people who are leaving the prison system?
Madam Chair, the current recidivism rate, which is the same, we use the same definition, frankly, for that purpose, is 32%, I believe, that commit a new crime within while they're out on parole or probation within 3 years.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of anyone on this panel? Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You alluded to this when we sort of set this stage for our informational hearing, but I may be missing part of this, so before you two would leave, I wanted to ask. You've done a good job of telling us about what I would call the existing procedures for conditional release, but it's part of our job here today, and maybe I've missed the point, to talk about how this current policy will or won't change as the hospital issue comes up. Are you looking at different procedures? Are you anticipating difficulty because we're building new sites, we're temporarily putting more in the community, are we bringing them back? I don't understand how that relates to the hospital situation.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, it's a good question. I'm under a lot of fire and heat from some friends for the size of the new state facilities that we're going to have. 980 beds are what are projected. It's primarily because we're going to continue to take the same operational perspectives and activities that we're currently doing now. We do think that as we develop more community resources, we can safely, using the same criteria, lower the length of stay somewhat in the new facilities. But the size of the facilities that we're talking about are largely, almost entirely, driven by our projections of Psychiatric Security Review Board. And I know this may strike people as, well, I hope people can just try to understand that we do not drive our discharges on the basis of census. With 30 Psychiatric Security Review Board patients, or I should say forensic patients, over our funded capacity right now at Oregon State Hospital. That's not what's, if that's what was driving it, we're doing a really poor job.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I would echo that. I will tell you that at no time when the board, and I've sat through most hearings that the board has held during my tenure as director, except if I were, you know, out of state, and never has the census at the hospital been a factor in determining whether an individual is appropriate for conditional release. The board takes great pride, and sometimes much to people's dissatisfaction, that is not. I mean, the board has a legal mandate, and it is very cautious to fulfill that mandate and not to be driven by census issues. It is, their decisions are based on both a clinical and public safety determination.
I may be missing something. You may be able to help me with this. So, the construction re-siting issues aren't driving a temporary policy to release more folks than we would normally to accommodate the construction. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I would say so. I will tell you that at all times, there have been, as a result of the lack of resources for this population, there have always been a number of individuals, and currently I would say there are currently 30 individuals in a forensic ward at the state hospital that have already been found by the board to be appropriate for conditional release, but for the fact that the resources aren't there. So I think what we're finding today is not so much that we're responding to the to the hospital census, it's that finally the resources have been provided to the Department of Human Services to develop the resources that have been needed for a very long time. It just happens that these two things are intersecting at the moment, but that in fact, and we have probably 64 individuals who are in the conditional release process. We have actually ordered community evaluations for these individuals. So this is not a temporary thing, but it's always been a factor. We just now have the resources to develop these facilities or residences in the community, and that's where we are today.
And I don't know if you want to. And I just want to add to that, I guess being on this committee four terms now, long before we talked about closing the hospital, we've had this same problem. Mm-hmm. People are ready to be released, mm-hmm. but there are no community facilities available for them. So it seems like we're always trying to catch up. Right. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I would say so. And Representative Gilliam, I would also tell you that part of that is that the board statute also says that the board cannot release an individual unless they can be adequately controlled and treated. And so it's the board's position that unless we have the residential and treatment services available for this individual, they need to remain in the hospital until those are available for them.
Well,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do want to add that you know we're presenting what we really believe is the best way of doing this business, and that's what we're trying to do. But I also want to recognize that other people have legitimate concerns. One group that I know you're going to hear from in a little bit is the District Attorney's Association. We are meeting with them. I think we've had two or three meetings, and we have a few more that I hope to have. And we're talking about issues like proportionality. You know, is there, if not a necessary, but is there at least an actual relationship between the seriousness and dangerousness of a crime and the period of time that people actually have to spend in the state facility? And in general, yeah, there is that kind of relationship. Whether we want to tie it down to hard and fast principles and numbers, that's probably more the area where the discussion is taking place and that we're continuing to talk with the district attorneys. We're also going to be meeting more with the courts, with judges, with court administrators. We'll also, I think, have a set of meetings before too long with the public defenders. There are a lot of interests here, and we're really trying our best to listen to all sides and take these things into consideration as we go about doing what we're doing.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we have a lot of other testimony, but I just want to be sure that I'm right when we're talking about the relationship of DHS siting. That means the new hospital or hospitals and the review board. We're talking about the integration of both, correct?
Well, the review board is not going to allow anybody to go back into the community unless they're absolutely assured that this is going to be an appropriate setting for these folks. Is that what you're asking?
I think so, because it just seems like we have a strange, I'm not going to call it a coincidence, but intersection of building this new facility and a need that I'm hearing to release more.
Oh.
And I'm wondering why we're building the facilities. I mean, we've got a huge, for lack of a better word, public opinion difficulty in understanding why we're building and why we're releasing. I'm oversimplifying, but that's my problem.
So why are we building new state hospitals to replace the one in Salem if we're also trying to put people in the community? Is that what you're asking? So, Doc, you want to answer that?
Good deal of what I'm asking. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Gilliam, great question. Last I checked, we have a similar PSRV system to the state of Connecticut, and that what I was surprised to see was that we're using the PSRV about three times as often in a similar size state as compared to Connecticut. So in my view is that while we're going to build more state facility beds, we also will continue to discharge a fairly large number of people simply because the sheer volume of people that come into the PSRV system. Now, maybe that's oversimplified, but that's how I look at the fact that we can continue to want to and need to build community resources as well as needing to account for, you know, assuming that we continue to use the PSRV, the guilty except for insanity option, to the degree that we are in this state, we'll need to do both.
So we have more people coming into the hospital, even if we're trying to allow more people to get into controlled settings in mm-hmm. the communities, correct? Any further?
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, one comment. I think more of the demographic pressure around the new state hospitals is going to be how we're not funding the front end, maybe necessarily the back end. But there are numbers involved with the state hospital, but I don't think it's all on the back end. But I think those are really good questions. My question was, for the settings that are not only PSRB clients, community settings that will take a person here or there, how are those community settings certified to take PSRB clients? Is there another process on top of them already providing other services in homes? Or I'm just wondering if there's an extra level of checking before we send folks into those facilities.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, there's not another level of certification, but there is another level of assurance that it's an appropriate facility. In other words, it has the kind of security structure, supervision built into the facility. Plus, there's always a PSRB monitor in the community, so that there's the additional staffing that we assure ourselves and the PSRB wants to assure that is there. So although there's not an additional certification process, attention is paid to the issues you're raising. I hope that answers the question.
And Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, if I can add, I personally go to each facility and train the staff prior to their admission. If they either have never served a PSRB clientele, or if it's a mixed population, because over the years we have started to mix extended care management and PSRB folks into different facilities, and so that is always been a concern of the board, because the legal status of these individuals is different. And so I will go to each one of these. Matter of fact, I was in Eastern Oregon last Monday training the staff of the new secure facility about what makes PSRB clients different and what the expectations are with regard to the staffing and supervision of our clients that might be different from the other half, because they're going to have another wing that serves civil patients. So we do pay great attention to that.
Thank you.
You had sent us out earlier, and unfortunately I didn't bring that printout with me, but it showed the different counties, how many clients had come from the different counties, and then the facilities provided the proportion. Do you have those with you, and could you address that just briefly?
Madam Chair, I didn't bring those with me, but I can get them for you, and maybe Andy Smith has them in the back of the room. If he does, we'll get them for you and get them over to staff right away.
Milwaukee is in Clackamas County, and I just noted that Clackamas County did not have its correct proportion of patients residing there. Did you have something else?
No, I don't have that with me.
Okay, but yes, please just send that to us. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
Because these are key testifiers, I have one more question before we let them go.
And I'm going to ask them to stay and
sure,
see if we have
absolutely.
Any other questions later.
By the way, if Andy Smith provides us material, we should probably look at it pretty carefully.
Absolutely.
You're working hard to make sure that public safety is obviously a concern or number one priority, and your training. Say a little bit about your current relationship or your current procedures with local law enforcement, because if you're moving out in all these counties, I think it's key how you're working with them or how they're prepared or alleviate any concerns they have or get their input on on how, in case of emergency or a situation. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, we do face that, the concern, and I would say that our practice has been, although maybe not as formalized as we might do in the future, is to have the provider who is setting up, as you well know, the state has to contract with private providers for these facilities. And we ask those providers to contact the local police, to introduce themselves, to talk about, what the needs might be for, to respond to the particular facility at each one of these new developments. So, there is some process for the provider to discuss, the needs and what might, what law enforcement requirements might be necessary. For example, if somebody has to be revoked, then, you know, our office would teletype the police to go to that facility, and they would know the locate, know that it, you know, was a facility for our clients, and to take that individual into custody and return them to the state hospital.
Madam Chair, if I could just add to that, Representative Gilliam, it's an interesting question. I actually haven't heard that before, and it occurs to me that we may be able to gather some data to get an idea of what is the time lapse between the PSRB notification of a revocation and the actual pickup. I think those are things that are knowable, if nothing else, on a sampling basis. So I do want to put on the record, though, that I haven't heard that there are issues there, but it's something that, that we could always take a look at.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I do want to say that in one experience that we had that might illustrate this is that when we developed a facility in Woodburn, I had conversations with that police chief who requested that she be notified of individuals who are placed in that facility, and we have accommodated that. So there is, you know, a communication when individuals, you know, request that.
Thank you so much. And if you stick around, I'd appreciate it. Okay, Bob Junge, Kim Wolfstrad, and David Del Valle. Del Valle? Thank you, Bob. I know that you sent us some material, which we all received.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the director of Oregon Advocacy Center, and I have provided you in advance a fairly short document that lays out the provisions of the Fair Housing Act and, in to a lesser extent, the Americans with Disabilities Act as it pertains to the rights of individuals with disabilities to be free of discrimination in their housing in the community. And I won't go over that in detail, except I'll just say that in some of the recent events that occurred in our communities, there's been questions as to whether the rights of individuals under the PSRB or in the hospital who are seeking to move into the community, if those rights have been violated. And I thought it was important for this committee just to be aware of those laws and that they do have an effect in these situations. Now, our organization, of course, has represented people who are in the hospital and people with disabilities across Oregon for many years, and we've been very involved with conditions in the hospital and trying to enforce the rights of the people who are there. And I just think, I don't want to take too much of your time, but I just want to emphasize to you that in my opinion, there's a great deal of misunderstanding about the people who are in that facility. The people who we are talking about under the PSRB who are people who have been found guilty except for insanity crimes. As my understanding is, and you might want to ask district attorneys who testify, that most of the people who come under the PSRB do so under plea agreements with the district attorney and the defense attorney in the court, which means that pretty much everybody agrees that this was an individual who didn't know what they were doing when the crime occurred because of the influence of a major mental disorder. They were under the influence of a major mental disorder, which affected their ability to control their behavior, which is why they're sent to a hospital and not to a prison for punishment. They're sent to the hospital in order to get treatment so that they can be safe in the future, so that the community can be safe in the future. And this is a type of legal arrangement that's existed for hundreds of years, frankly, in our jurisprudence. And it's a fairly enlightened policy, I'd submit to you, because it recognizes that these mental illnesses are very profound and they can have tragic consequences for both community members and for the individuals involved. And so they're in the hospital to get better. And the way that our law works is that when they get sent to the hospital, they're sent for the maximum up to the maximum period of time that they might have received had they been convicted of a crime. So the deal is Again, contrary to what might be the public perception that an insanity defense is a way to get out of responsibility for something, the fact is that in the great number of cases, the people spend more time in the state hospital, they spend more time under the PSRB than they would had they been convicted of the crime and sent to prison or jail for that particular crime. Once they're there, however, their job is to get better. And, of course, they're interested in doing that for the most part, and they're interested in doing what they need to do in order to transition back into our community, because ultimately they will. And it's best for everyone if they get good treatment, if their treatment follows a process of reintegration into the community so that when they're ready to be released, which ultimately virtually every one of them will be, that they are going to be as safe as possible, they're going to be as well as possible, and the community is going to be as safe as possible. And that means stepping down into the most appropriate levels of treatment. So for that person, they, when they're in the hospital, they're told what they need to do in order to get better and what they need to do to step down. Now, as you heard from Ms. Buckley, there's a great backlog in terms of being able to do that. Right now, there's 30 people who have been found to be safe and well by not only the hospital medical staff and the hospital administration, but the PSRB, whose job it is to only determine whether that person is safe to be in the community. And there's 30 folks who have done everything they need to do and are appropriate to leave and to step down and to continue in their recovery process, but they can't. And they remain in the Oregon State Hospital. Now, remember what Mr. Nichols said, is that the state hospital is overfunded capacity. The state hospital has been overfunded capacity for as long as I can remember, and I've been advocating for this group of people for 20 years. Oregon Advocacy Center represented those people in the lawsuit just 2 years ago because, as we alleged, and I believe to be the case, that the conditions in that hospital did not meet minimum constitutional standards. It was overcrowded, understaffed, and dangerous for the people who live there. That case, there was a settlement agreement in that case, and the legislature funded more staff positions in the hospital and funded the creation of more community placements in order to relieve some of the pressure on the hospital's census. And probably as a side factor of that, there was a recognition that, for example, the oldest building in the hospital has been found seismically unsafe for residents. And even though that determination was made 2 years ago, you probably know that there's still two wards of patients who are still in that building and being served by staff every day, even though the building has been found to be unsafe. And for those of you who have toured the other parts of the hospital, you understand that these are less than ideal treatment environments. And that is why we've made the enlightened decision to go ahead and build a new state hospital. So those individuals who have been found ready to go have done everything that they need to do. They've been found safe by three groups of professionals, can't leave, can't make any progress in their treatment, and are stuck in what I would submit to you is an institution that we should all be ashamed exists in our state. It's a bad situation. What we need to be able to do is to get those community facilities built. And I can tell you that the facilities that we agreed to in our lawsuit, 80% of them were never built. 80% of them were never built. And you could ask Mr. Nichol why that is, but I know that one of the reasons is that there's a sense of community opposition to the creation of those facilities, and it's difficult to get providers to step forward and to have community mental health agencies step forward to do the job. So we have a problem. And I, of course, anybody who has been watching this situation for years knows that there's a great deal of community anxiety about a facility of this sort. It's very understandable. However, I think that if you examine the facts and if community members examine the facts, you'll see that these facilities are what I call safety zones because they contain people who have been, again, found by three professional bodies to be safe. They're under 24/7 care. They're supervised both in the facility and outside of the facility, and if you talk to providers, community providers, they will say that these are the best resourced, the best patrolled, and the safest facilities that we have in the state. The last thing I want to mention is that why I gave you the rundown about the Fair Housing Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. These laws exist because there is a recognition federally that there is a great deal of prejudice against people with disabilities. And of course, you add the PSRB label, and that's going to only be increased. But these are people with psychiatric disabilities. The only reason they need to live in a group home is because they have a psychiatric disability. If they'd gone off to prison, they would have just been released into the community. No neighbor would have any say as to whether that individual lived in their community or not. So they're living where they live only because they have a mental illness. And what the law says, essentially, is that the ADA says that people have a right not to be unnecessarily segregated because of their disability, because of their mental illness. And so we just can't take a whole bunch of people who have mental illness, put them all in one big building, and say we're done with it. That is viewed to be discriminatory because it's segregating them because of a psychiatric label. The Fair Housing Act says that for a person with disabilities, their right to live in a community should be the same as everybody else's. So if you want to move into a neighborhood, you don't have to get the okay from all the people in the neighborhood, and everybody doesn't have to know about your history and what medications you're taking and what doctor you're seeing. That's not required of folks who want to move in our society, and the Fair Housing Act says it should be the rule for people who have to live in a group setting because they have a disability. And in essence, our job at the Oregon Advocacy Center is to enforce those rights, and that's why we've been involved in some of these matters. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions of Mr. Junda?
I do.
Yes.
Bob, I do have one question. It's because I don't understand, and maybe you can help me out. Is on page 4 of your handout, specifically about residents of correctional transition, are the people that are under the jurisdiction of the PSRB, are they a protected class? They're not a protected class.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, our position is they are a protected class, and we believe that they are a protected class because they are not coming through the correction system. They're not living in these community facilities because they have been convicted of crimes and are being released from prison or jail. They're here because of their psychiatric treatment needs.
Follow up. So, because I live at the south end of the state, I have not been immersed with the media onslaught regarding the Milwaukee situation, specifically the Milwaukee situation. And is it your opinion that the Milwaukee, is it the city or city council, inappropriately acted in their actions of buying this house or this lot?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, the Advocacy Center did send a letter to the Milwaukee City Council telling them that, in our opinion, that they had violated the Fair Housing Act by taking the actions that they did.
if I may, a couple more. The PSRB just stated that they contact local counties when placing PSRB patients in that county, and that they either accept them or not accept them. Is that a violation of the Fair Housing Act, as you'd see?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I think it would be important for you to get a little more clarity in from that
That's
statement.
Why I'm asking the question.
Because notification about the creation of a facility is a different question than notification about to a public body about individuals. Now, what Ms. Buckley may have been referring to has been referring to the county mental health agency, because when an individual is placed in a facility, they will normally get their outpatient psychiatric services from the county mental health agency. And so in order to effectuate a placement, that person would need to be accepted by the facility, the nonprofit operator of the facility, and by the county mental health agency, which may be a county agency, it may be a nonprofit that contracts with the county, but there'll be two separate entities. Now, the confidential information that would travel to the mental health provider, that county agency, would not be appropriately released to members of the public or elected officials. So there would be a restriction in doing so. So I believe that what she was referring to was sending information to the clinical entity, the county mental health agency, but you'd have to clarify that with her.
We'll have her up later.
I'll stop.
No, you can ask.
No, I will stop because
okay. You want to clarify with her later. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you so much, Bob.
Madam Chair, my name is David Del Valle, and with your permission, I'd like to take the next turn. We've had a substitution in our lineup.
Sure.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Del Valle. I am the Executive Director at NAMI Oregon, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We're a statewide organization. We have 17 local affiliates, mostly on the county level, and we represent thousands of Oregonians that have mental illness and their families. My role today is just to restate our long-standing position on treating and providing services to individuals with mental illness, whether they're PSRB or not, in the community whenever clinically appropriate. Over the years, I think you have heard that there has been difficulty in having people transition out of the state hospital for lack of resources in the community. We have consistently over the years advocated for more funding to go for community mental health services across the board, making sure that there is a wide array of choices. And again, whether it's the review board or social workers at the state hospital, that when someone is deemed safe and appropriate to be in the community, we have options. One of the things that is a tragedy, I think, in the testimony that you've heard before, is that there are people ready to go into the community and make a go of it, lead productive lives, lead a different type of life than in the institution, what have you, and no place to go. So we definitely are in support of looking at options and looking to create residential opportunities for those individuals. That said, as Mr. Nickel had said earlier, we're neighbors too. And one of the things that NAMI has stood for a long time is that those services be of a quality standard, and quality meaning security for the residents, security for the community, appropriate staffing levels, a clean facility, and essentially the services that are going to help them be successful in the community placement. The last thing that we want to do is to have someone leave the state hospital and receive services that would otherwise set them up for failure and a return to the state hospital or a return to another facility. So one of the things that we definitely want to see is to have the dialogue with the community, to have the dialogue between the providers and law enforcement, the providers, and the hospitals to make sure that there is appropriate coordination among all aspects of that community. That's very important for the success of the individual, for the success of the community, and of the provider. In my professional experience, I have been a mental health community service provider, including residential facilities. And I can tell you that even without any PSRB individuals being a part of our residential programs that we were trying to place in communities, sometimes it is a tough sell for the community. And my personal opinion and professional opinion is that's largely born out of fear of the unknown. Mm-hmm. And I look at it as an opportunity for education for the community, and have attended, like Mr. Nickel, many community meetings where I was trying to talk with people about what mental illness really is, what people are like when they are stable with the appropriate services and with the appropriate treatment, and our goal of helping those individuals become productive citizens, lead meaningful lives, have reasons to get up in the morning, just like all of us. Those are things that we need, and those are things that they need as well. So with that, I am going to introduce Molly Gorger, who is sitting in for Kim Rolstedt. Molly has a son under the PSRB jurisdiction, and over the years has come to know many individuals under that same jurisdiction. Molly Gorger, it's G-O-R-G-E-R, is a member of NAMI and NAMI Washington County. So with that, Molly.
Have you ever done this before, Molly? Have you ever done this before? Well, just take a breath. We're all just down-home folks.
Yeah, I want you all to smile for me, okay?
Okay, you bet.
So, hello, and I thank you for the opportunity to come and speak.
I need you to state your name.
Oh, Molly Gorger.
He's the one you need to be afraid of.
He's no.
Yeah. We're nice on this end.
As there's so many things that are being said that I wanted to respond to. We went through a tragedy. My son got very ill, and I lost him. He went into his illness, and there was a tragedy. And I am blessed, we're blessed that he got to go to the state hospital and was put under the PSRB. The PSRB is like the answer for people that have committed a crime because of their illness. It's a safety hatch. We don't have the community mental health that we need for all the people that experience symptoms of mental illness. And if ever, well, I should say the hospital brought my son back. He's back. He's here. He's stable. He's good. He's thinking clearly. He's here. And, Nancy, smile, okay. He was up for a conditional release. He asked for a conditional release and was interviewed by the community, and it was a good fit because they want to make sure the person going into the home fits with the rest of the clients in the home. And he was not allowed his conditional release because the PSRB thought, because there was one piece of his, well, for many reasons, one piece of his therapy that he hadn't completed. And they wanted him to complete that, and then he could ask for conditional release again in 6 months. And he has completed that. And I guess what I'm trying to say is they are so careful, and we feel that if he ever, ever has any trouble, the PSRB is there, and they will snap him right back up for just, you know, if he starts to decompensate or if he struggles with his medicine or anything, that they are there for not only the community, but for him. They are there for him. And there's so much more I'd like to tell you. I, too, agree that fear, it's fear. So many people don't know about what happens to the brain when it starts firing improperly. And education, in my opinion, is where we need to go. And these people are like us. They're the same as us. They just have a brain disorder. I find mine likes to call it an intermittent electrical difficulties because of how the brain works with the electrical. And when they've had therapy and when they're on a medication and they've gone through, one of you could be sitting there with an illness and none of us would know because you're acting in a smile. As a quote normal person would. They are normal people that have a problem with how their brain works. But medication and therapy helps it work better. So I could go on it now that I have a mic.
Molly, is he still in the hospital or is he in the community?
He's in the hospital still.
And so he's in line eventually to get into the community if there is a spot available.
And there aren't spots available. There's so many. As long as I've been involved with the hospital, they've always had people ready to go, but no place to go. It's tough to be somebody with one of these serious brain disorders and have to put up with all the stigma and the crimes they may have committed, to have to come out of their nightmare, basically. It's like have you ever had a nightmare where you woke up shaking and but thank God it was just a nightmare? They go to the hospital and they wake up and find out it wasn't just a nightmare. They lived it. And the hospital wakes them up, and they realize they can move on and go into life and be productive citizens, move them out, and then the other people that need it can go back in the hospital, rotating rather than rotating new clients, I hope, than having them just sit there.
Molly, have you visited any of these facilities in your community?
Of the mental health facilities?
Mm-hmm.
Very few, but some.
You have visited some. Can you tell us a little bit about, are there any Washington County that you visited, and if so, what were they like?
Depressing.
The facility itself is depressing?
Sometimes, yes. The one in Washington County was depressing. Not all of them are depressing, but... And I think it has to do around with the care of the people that we have in our lives with mental illness. And I think it's ignorance, and that's not being bad, but just that we don't know. You know, there's so much people don't know about the brain. And we've learned so much about the brain in just like the 15 years. Imagine where we could go from here.
Thank you.
Any questions? Yeah. Representative Gillian.
You did say he was the dangerous one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I really appreciate all of you coming. I particularly appreciate you, Molly. I cannot pretend to know what you've been through in your family, but I appreciate you sharing it. My question actually is for Mr. Davali, because both of you touched on the fear issue, and I would agree. I also would say there's fear of the unknown, which is one of the issues we face with public perception, but there's also fear of the known, whether that's blown out of proportion because of law and order or because of media coverage is probably also part of the debate. I want to get back to this relationship. That's why I want to ask you. The relationship with local law enforcement, in the absence of Representative Olson, I think I should take on that role. It's so important in this whole equation, that's why I had a question earlier, that particularly local law enforcement, is involved. And I would like you, if you could, to talk a little bit about that. You touched on it, but just say a little bit more about what we can do to improve that, because I think they are a very logical bridge. And lastly, I'll just comment, and I don't mean this facetiously at all, but there is, we had great testimony, and but there also is word on the street, to use a phrase, that people are unhappy, that we've had a number of incidents, and it is increasing the fear. And if public safety is our number one issue here, and then we can get to the rights of folks, then I need to know a little bit more about what we're doing to involve law enforcement.
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative Gilliam, it is a critical bridge, and one of the things that I did as a provider was make sure that folks in the Sheriff's Office and our local police departments knew who we were, where we were. They were introduced to our residential program directors at a time that was not of a crisis, so that during a crisis, the response and the communication was a lot easier, a lot more thorough, et cetera. There's also something that's happening over the last several years called crisis intervention training, and that is training for law enforcement personnel about mental illness, doing the education that is necessary for them to understand what they are looking at when they come onto a scene. Because of course, they need to react to the public safety aspect of what is happening during a crisis, and we certainly understand that. We also, during the crisis intervention training, try to help them interpret some of the other symptoms they may be looking at, and also to know what other options are out there, other resources that are out there, in order to help a situation, help diffuse a situation so that it does not get more dangerous than it might. So I have been very consistent in being a very strong advocate for making sure that law enforcement does know what we are doing and how we are trying to accomplish that, and have been proactive in that regard.
Representative Gilliam, I just want to respond a little bit to your question. Certainly we see a lot in the media, the newspapers and television about mentally ill people doing things that are very frightening to the public. It doesn't sound like that is this population. This population is closely supervised and monitored. So I think the ones that we hear about are not the ones who have been sent to the state hospital or in supervision of mental health agencies, but are perhaps themselves mentally ill and are not in these more supervisors or safe situations. So,
I'm not knowing, you know, what the recidivism rate is very low, and you made a very good point about the actual instances. But I don't know how many of these folks under this program. And by the way, we've broken our rule about 400 times.
Psychiatric Review Board.
Thank you. The Psychiatric Security Review Board. If you say PSRB in my district, you might think there was a bull riding competition going on. So we don't use acronyms. But I don't know how many of the folks under the program have been in these high-profile cases.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the numbers are very important. You made that point. I agree. But the public perception around some of these really violent incidences are, I'm not well-versed enough to tell you that the folks under the review board are the ones doing this, but I think there have been several cases where that has happened.
And we'll ask.
And that is what is concerning local law enforcement in our communities. And then you go back to ground zero again in terms of awareness and education and relationship, because it's a very scary situation.
Okay. Representative, I know you have a question to Mr. Junda.
Yeah. Bob, in your opinion, is the PSRB, and I won't state it again, but we'll just, because we'll assume at this point we're using PSRB.
Yes.
Is that okay, Matt?
That's okay.
Thank you.
Are
they doing their job?
Madam Chair, Representative Bauer, from the viewpoint of the patients in the hospital, they're considered to be extremely diligent, if not overly zealous. My view is that they do an appropriate job. I've been critical in the past of some of the communications they have with folks in the hospital, because when there's trouble with communication, it means a person doesn't leave because it defaults to a package not moving forward and the person not being ready. And as a patient advocate, we're hoping to help that process move along. So I think that they take their job of public safety very seriously. And I honestly can't think of one instance in which, at least in my knowledge, that they moved somebody into a community facility that I felt was inappropriate. In fact, one of the issues that we've had was that we, as a result of our lawsuit, is we were encouraging them to move people more rapidly and to move them to directly from the hospital to less secure settings, and they wouldn't go there at all.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I hope you come back again, and best wishes with your family and your son.
Thank you.
So we're going to hear from, I think, Lieutenant Sean Fisher, right? You're going to correct me? Okay. John Foote, District Attorney. Good to see you, John. And Bob Herman, District Attorney in Washington County. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming. Do we have somebody else?
Good afternoon, I guess it's still good morning. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is John Foote, and I have the privilege of serving as the DA in Clackamas County, and I have a letter and a couple of attachments for your review. And I want to take a little bit of a different tack. But I first want to say that there are really good people working at the state hospital and working at the PSRB, trying to do the very best for the patients there and considering what their responsibilities are. And I want to say that up front. This is not about whether or not there are good people working there. We know there are. But something's changed in the way violent criminals are being handled by the state hospital in recent years. And I say that because first we saw some, DAs around the state saw some individual cases. We had one in Clackamas County, Lee Boycha, who was found guilty, except for insanity, for murder. Shot a young 17-year-old girl. Was clearly delusional. We stipulated to the finding. And less than about 3 years later, a doctor at the state hospital was recommending him being moved to the community. We didn't used to see that. That's outlined in my letter. Mr. Herman in Washington County had a case as well. Unfortunately, it was the Gorger case, which also was in our county, which had some of the same concerns. And there are other incidences like this that caused DAs around the state to start asking questions. What's happening? We didn't used to see this happen. People being considered for community placement so quickly after very serious crimes. So we began having meetings with the state hospital and Mr. Nichols' office. We asked for those meetings to find out why, what was going on, and was this a pattern? And I've attached for you a letter from Mr. Nichol, which we requested some information about were things changing. And we wanted to particularly talk about violent crimes. And as you can see from Mr. Nichol's letter, which we very much appreciated, there has been a change, which appears to be consistent with our perception, which is the length of stay for people for violent crimes when in state hospital on guilty except for insanity dispositions has been shortened. And I think that pattern is going to continue. Particularly when I read for the first time recently the executive summary of the framework plan for the new state hospital and see the emphasis in there on community placement. Now, I think it's important for us to emphasize that we are not here to talk about non-forensic patients. We're not here to talk about what everyone acknowledges is a tough job about placing mentally ill people in the community. We're very supportive of that. We understand that. These are members of our community. Every one of us has had somebody in our family, me included, who suffered from serious mental illness. We know how tough that can be. We're talking about public safety. And PSRB people who committed violent crimes, in our view, are a special public safety concern. And they needed to be treated as such. And that is why we have raised these concerns. We do not think this is fundamentally an issue of capacity. We think this is an issue of approach. Our concern is the new planning for the state hospital. If, in our view, we don't see much discussion or participation by public safety in those conversations. That causes us concern. What we're looking for is a balance between public safety and the proper handling of people who have mental illness when it comes to people who have committed violent crime. Traditionally, in the last 10 or 15 years, we've had a very, we being I think the DAs, have had a very good relationship with the PSRB and the state hospital. On general, there always are issues, but because these are tough subjects. But I think there's been a relationship of trust. And unfortunately, these incidences have caused us to ask questions. What we want to do is go back to that relationship of trust. That's what we're looking for. And we're looking for any way to do it. That's why we've begun these conversations with Mr. Nichols' office and the State Hospital and the PSRB. We want to continue those conversations. But what we're looking for is an acknowledgement that something has changed, which I think we've found, and then a willingness to go back and start incorporating public safety conversation and considerations in the planning and implementation of how we handle violent criminals who are within the PSRB for a criminal conviction, but guilty but except for insanity. So we're looking forward to solutions. We don't want to increase the fear, although, you know, Milwaukee is in Clackamas County. I understand the concerns of the community, but we don't want to increase fear. What we want to do is strike that proper balance. So thank you for listening to my comments. I'd be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
So, John, this is the first time that I've seen this letter, so it's trying to listen to you and look at this letter. So the average stay, looking at Mr. Nichols' letter, in the past was 1,900 to 1,400 days for commission of violent crimes. Now it's 1,200 days. Am I reading that correctly?
I will defer to Mr. Nichols on that question, but it appears that you are reading it correctly to me. Yes, you are.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, John, and we'll ask him later. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Sean Fisher. I'm a lieutenant with the Washington County Sheriff's Office with the Investigations Division. I supervise a number of teams, including the Sexual Assault Unit. I appreciate being here to talk about this important issue today. I'm here representing my sheriff, Sheriff Rob Gordon, as well as several members of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Sheriff Gordon sends his apologies. He would have liked to be here himself today, but is actually in Central Oregon meeting with those other sheriffs, talking about a number of important issues, including this very one. Before I say what I wanted to say, I wanted to mention that I'm encouraged by some of the things I've heard today. It appears that public safety is a primary concern for all of us involved. That's encouraging to me. I think our main point is that we want to be part of a collaborative effort with regard to this issue. And I wonder if our experience, at least, is a little bit like maybe that that philosophy has not borne itself out in practice. And I'll explain a little later. What I'd like to do is just share with you the story of how Washington County, the Sheriff's Office, became involved in this issue. And that starts with a man named Matthew Shipley. I sent some information that you have in front of you that we received as part of a public records request from the Psychiatric Security Review Board. We had first contact with Mr. Shipley in May 7th of 1988. He's not new to law enforcement contact at the time. In fact, he'd been arrested and convicted for a number of crimes in the preceding 5 years before we contacted him. Those crimes included things such, you know, theft, mischief, controlled substances, failure to appear, that sort of thing. And sometime during that 5 years, the record also indicates that he was deemed to have some sort of mental illness. But it was May 7th, 1988, that we first had contact with Mr. Shipley and Deputy Randy Kafis. We'll likely not forget that night. He responded to the call of a sexual assault occurring now. He happened to be very close to the call and raced into the area. What he found were two children, one of whom was screaming, "A man over there is hurting my sister." He pointed around the corner behind a grocery store and some dumpsters. What I'd like to do is just read in Deputy Kafis' own words what he saw next, a couple excerpts from his report. He says, "I observed the dumpsters in line and angled away from a chain link fence. As my patrol car came into the same line of sight, I observed the suspect on his knees and leaning over a very young girl. As my patrol car came even with the dumpster, I observed the suspect stand up. I observed the little girl on her hands and knees. I observed Mr. Shipley's pants down near his ankles." And then a few sentences later, Deputy Kafis writes, "I observed the little girl on her hands and knees. She was resting on her back legs. The little girl's pants and underclothing were down by her feet. The little girl looked at me, and she seemed to be in shock and completely horrified. This victim was a 3-year-old girl. She'd been walking in the neighborhood with her older brother and sister when Mr. Shipley grabbed her and took her behind the store. During the interview with Deputy Kafis, Mr. Shipley's request of Deputy Kafis was that if at all possible, he be released back to Damish State Hospital, which is where he had escaped earlier that day. As a result of that incident, Mr. Shipley was convicted, except for insanity, of rape one, kidnapping one, and attempted sodomy one, and he was sentenced to 50 years under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Fast forward a few years. This past summer, Sheriff Gordon started hearing some rumors that there were some dangerous people living in our community in Washington County. He did this public records request with the Psychiatric Security Review Board, found out that in July of 2007, there had been 8 individuals that were given conditional releases and sent to the Connell House, which is in Cornelius, Oregon, in Washington County. We also learned that there were approximately 14 other people that had been given conditional releases into other areas of Washington County. Just to put it in perspective, the Connell House sits right in between a group of newer homes in Cornelius with young families and a convenience store that attracts these young kids right past Connell House. Suffice it to say, we at the sheriff's office were completely surprised to find out that these people were living in our neighborhood. I've heard some testimony today about interaction with law enforcement. That was not the case in this instance. We did not know that these people were living in Cornelius.
When you say these people, are you saying that all of the residents of that facility were under the PSRB?
Eight of them were. I'm not sure if all of them are. I know that Chief Rubenstein, Chief of Police from Cornelius, is here today. I'm sure he would love to say a few words if the committee would allow him. It's my understanding that the city is still considering whether to revoke the conditional use permit for that facility based on the fact that it's not being used as they were told. They were told or were under the impression that this facility would be used for rather low-risk substance abusers and that sort of thing. not dangerous criminals like Mr. Shipley. This facility, which I have visited since, it's called a secure facility, but in my opinion, it was not designed to prevent escape. They're rather modest security features. Primarily, it would appear that medications and voluntary compliance with staff and rules are the main security features for this facility. There are alarms and locks, but this seems a rather risky way to handle some of our most dangerous people. We think that this is a dangerous situation and that it's our responsibility to say something about it. Again, we want to work collaboratively. That's our goal here. But we feel that it's important for us to say this seems dangerous to us. That exacerbating the situation is what seems to us a lack of transparency in this process. Again, we didn't know that these folks were being cited into this neighborhood. And it gave us the appearance that they were being deliberately secretive in moving these people into this neighborhood. I'm not suggesting that they were. That's the way it seemed to us. That's how it felt. We think that as a matter of public policy, these kinds of discussions need to be handled in a very open, very honest fashion, collaboratively with everybody who's affected. And since I represent law enforcement, I will say specifically, and especially law enforcement, we're the ones who will be responding when there are problems there. We need to know who's there. We need to know the layouts of these buildings. We need to know their security features. We need to know the key codes to get in the gates, if there are gates. These are things that we need to know in order to be effective at providing public safety, not only to the citizens or residents who live there, but the citizens of the communities where these homes are located. A final comment. It's obvious that there has been some sort of policy decision about moving these forensic clients out of state hospitals and into group homes in our communities. I don't know why. That's probably not for me to decide why that policy decision came about. I don't know if it's dollars and cents or if it has something to do with the treatment. I can certainly appreciate that maybe being in a more home-like group home environment is more conducive to psychiatric therapy. Maybe it's even cheaper to run group homes as opposed to large state hospitals. I don't know. If it's more effective or more efficient to use group homes, great, let's do that. But I would suggest we put those group homes in places that are collaboratively located or on state hospital grounds. It seems to make sense that these people, we can't forget, they were convicted of crimes, except for insanity. And they were given sentences to keep them separated from society because they have issues that they needed to be dealt with. So there was a reason that they were separated. So we need to remember that. That's all I have. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. The case that you cited here, Mr. Shipley, so this the offense happened in 1988, correct? So it's been 19 years, if I... Okay. So if he hadn't pleaded guilty except for insanity, how long would his sentence have been?
It's hard for me to say. That's certainly not my purview. But right. I think 20 years, I think, was the...
If that were the case, if it were 20 years, then that's the longest.
For one of those crimes, I believe the rape one. I'll defer that to District Attorney Bob Herman.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Herman, do you want to? Who did I? I said. I missed Mr. Fisher. I'm sorry, Mr. Fisher. Right. Players next set.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Herman. I'm the district attorney in Washington County and have been elected. I'm in my third term now. I've been a prosecutor in Washington County since 1975. First, Madam Chair, in answer to your question, ironically, I was the prosecutor in the case involving Mr. Shipley. So had he not been found guilty except for insanity, or actually it was a different term back then, in GBI, but that would have been subject to litigation. I can guarantee you, because there was no Measure 11 and there was no sentencing guidelines at that time, the state, I most likely would have argued for 60 with a minimum 30, which was subject to the parole board's discretion whether they'd override that sentence. What a judge would have imposed is probably subject to, you know, debate. But I suspect he would have served probably a similar time frame. I would expect it, in light of the conduct, at least a minimum 20 years.
So if that were the case, his 20 years is almost up. So then he would theoretically go into the community under the jurisdiction of the parole board.
Correct.
Right? He would not be in a facility such as this that where he would his behavior
Correct.
Would be monitored. Okay, thank you. And please continue with your presentation.
Thank you. And if I might just follow, that's part of my theme. He would have, there would have been a public notification, or at least law enforcement would have been notified by the parole board, that process. And most likely he would have been classified as a sexually dangerous predator, and the underpinnings of that law would have gone into effect if he'd been in the criminal system. But just briefly, if I might, again, I'm really here to emphasize the public safety aspect and concerns of this issue. I know there's a lot of different levels that we're talking about regarding the state hospital and the PSRB. I, too, as is Mr. Foots, a member of the committee Mr. Nickel referred to, we're working with DHS State Hospital regarding some issues, and I just divert just for a second to say one of the things we're discussing in some earnest now, I think, is the huge crunch that's put on the state hospital for aid and assist evaluations of people from our local communities, many with relatively minor criminal acts that are being sent to the state hospital by our courts for evaluations. And I think Mr. Nickel can better give the figure, but I want to say they're 40 over capacity on any given day. And it's separate from this issue, except that I want to emphasize we're working to try to see in Washington County, we've got a judge that's going to get involved to see if we can handle some of those situations and those people locally so they're taken out of the criminal process earlier rather than later, and at the same time trying not to drain the state resources, the state hospital, which are greatly overtaxed as it is. But on to this topic, I'm here to talk about, as I said, public safety and some suggestions that I believe should be considered, that I think it's important, as Lieutenant Fisher said, to increase the public's awareness and confidence in the process. We can have the debate about whether someone should be released or not released. That's almost a separate issue. I believe there should be a process where, as a matter of course, the PSRB notifies local law enforcement, sheriff, city police, that a release of this offender, conditional release of this offender, is being made to their community, so that from their perspective they can prepare for any issues that may arise, and if none arise, fine, but at least they're aware of who is cited in their community. Presently, the PSRB does an excellent job, I assume, because being a prosecutor for all these years, I can actually remember every single case that was sent to the PSRB, usually by agreement, rarely by court trial order. And so all those come to me. So I get all the notifications of people that are released from Washington County. Many of them are released to Washington County, but I can think of a murder case that was released to Lane County, and quite frankly, I don't know if Lane County was aware that that person was placed in their community or not. So the DAs get that notice, but I think from a public safety perspective, law enforcement should get that notice. And I think, quite frankly, the issue of whether a person should be designated as a sexual predator in the community, the same consideration should be made as it is with someone that Department of Corrections releases. At least that discussion should be held about whether that notification should be made that that person is in the community. I would I would differ a little bit from one of the prior speakers, and Mr. Foote made the point that we're talking about forensic cases. It's important to remember that the people that the PSRB sees are not there just because of a mental illness. They're there because they committed an act which would have been, which is a crime, but for their mental illness, they would have most likely been in state institutions. And as Representative Gilliam asked earlier, these are the high-profile cases. These are the murder cases, the sexual assault cases, the child molestation cases that we often hear about in our communities. And although some may say it's a hysteria or paranoia, it's important to recognize that these cases have real victims, people who have been harmed, whose family members have been murdered, have been sexually assaulted. These are people that have a very real and legitimate fear that their offender may be released in the community. And it's something that we can't lose sight of, that these people, albeit because by agreement that it was because of a mental illness, they were unable to either appreciate the criminality of what they did or control themselves. Nonetheless, there were real victims, there was real fear, and there's real concern. And so I think part of the problem is when this is done in less than an open way and people find out somebody's in the community, there's a very visceral reaction, and some of it may be overboard, some of it maybe, you know, very legitimate concern, but I think from a public safety perspective, whatever we can do to make this in an open and honest process, and if it's defensible, if the release is defensible, then defend it. And I think, quite frankly, that's the best way that we can approach this this issue with everybody making their arguments. I'd be remiss if I didn't say one further thing, and this is not a shot at the PSRB, because this is the accepted standard, as I understand it, of as Ms. Buckley said, I think the Department of Corrections uses the same thing, of recidivism. And if I'm correct, and I hope I am, this has come up before, but recidivism, I believe, is classified as a felony conviction within 3 years of release. And in previous legislative issues, I've testified before that means an assault, a public indecency on the school grounds, driving under the influence charge, and a whole array of other crimes for which there are one or more convictions are not considered in the recidivism conduct.
Can we state that, please?
Sure. As I understand it, and
we'll check with.
Yeah, as I understand it, the standard used in Oregon for recidivism is that you must have been convicted of a felony within 3 years of your release date. So, assault 4, public indecency, DUII are just a few crimes that are misdemeanors by law. And so, in theory, under that criteria, you could have, I guess, 6 or 10 public indecency, exposing yourself in front of school children, convictions, and they wouldn't qualify as under the measure as a recidivism act. In fact, you could have a murder case where if it was 2 years after your release and was still pending after the three-year time period, that in theory wouldn't be recidivism. I'm not suggesting that wouldn't, any of those hacks wouldn't immediately result in revocation by the PSRB, but it's that standard that's used for recidivism that's carries, in my opinion, a little, NDA's opinions, a little red flag that you know, be careful what it means. It doesn't mean they're completely law-abiding citizens.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Herman, can I just clarify then, if we wanted a higher standard for the definition of recidivism, so the 30% number that they're using to compare theirs would also be different? Is it? I'm just, because they're
absolutely
using the same standard here.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
And there's, you know, in defense, we've had the discussion, there's reasons because of the record keeping of misdemeanors and so forth, but it can be misleading in terms of law, you know, law violations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Quick question,
yes,
if I may. And if you don't know the answer to this, it's fine. This is for anybody. Does the PSRB have the authority to contact local DAs without a change in the law to make that?
Yes. Well, they do. They routinely, I mean, to my experience, in every case, they've done it for years, so I don't know.
Well, but you said you don't know if Lane County was.
Well, they notified me because it was a case that came out of Washington County, but if the person was being placed in a home in or in a setting in Lane County, I presume they don't notify the DA or anyone in Lane County that Joe Smith is going to be placed there. So it's the notification is to the DA from the county in which the defendant committed the original crime and was sent to the state hospital.
So that's part of their routine.
Correct.
Procedure, but it's not about placement, or it's not to where they're right. placed.
That's my understanding.
They would probably know this better than we do, because obviously we don't know what they're not telling us, but we think it's really about kind of who owns the conviction, who gets the notice, or the guilty but insanity, except for insanity.
Then I guess the PSRB would know what the follow-up question will be.
Any further questions for this panel?
Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we're going to call back Mr. Nickel and Buckley. I should have asked, maybe I should ask this of one of you. So if there is not a place in the community treatment center for somebody who has committed a crime and has spent their full time that they would have spent in a prison, they've spent that full time in the state hospital, and you haven't found room for them to be in a conditional release in the community, then would they be released directly from the hospital into the community after they'd served the full amount of time that they would have served in the prison?
Chair Tomei, that's correct, unless the hospital staff deem them appropriate for a civil commitment proceeding. But the court puts them on, it gives us a legal length of jurisdiction, and once that lapses, that's the end, and nobody would have any further legal authority over those individuals.
Would they be on probation or parole?
Madam Chair, no.
So they would go directly from the hospital into the community with no follow-up, no treatment?
Chair Tomei, I think that the hospital is well aware of the end of jurisdiction, and the hospital staff would work closely with the patient to develop a discharge plan and find them housing and refer them to mental health, you know, treatment or, you know, an agency to work with them. But there would be no legal authority to force them to do that. They would really be free to choose to do it or not. But the hospital does develop a discharge plan for every client. If they are going to be released from the hospital.
So I'm just going to follow up on that, and Bob chime in. But so if I'm Jane Blow and I've committed a crime and I've served my 20 years in the state hospital, and you haven't been able to find a place for me in the community, and I've served my time, then I will go directly to the community, and you might offer me mental health services, but I don't have to partake of that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yeah, that's essentially correct. I'd be really disappointed in our staff, and the Joint Commission standards would not smile upon a practice where we didn't try not only to find a placement, but also to persuade the patient and the family to accept that. Mary Claire Buckley is correct that unless we go through a civil commitment process or, I suppose, a guardianship proceeding, we couldn't force that, but there's so much that can be done, I think, to help persuade people that it's in their best interest to accept a reasonable discharge plan, that I would expect our staff to do everything that they could.
Thank you. Now, I know that there are questions. Did you have a follow-up question?
I did.
Yes.
Thank you. The question is, do you have the authority, PSRB have the authority to contact district attorneys in jurisdictions that you're putting back into the community? Not to the place they were convicted, but back to where they're being placed.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, the statute that we follow at this time indicates that we are to give notice to judges, DAs, and victims for the locations from whence they were committed, as Mr. Herman alluded to. So we give notification regarding every hearing and the results thereafter to those parties. There is nothing in our statute at this time that would direct the board to provide the order of conditional release to law enforcement in the county to which they are being moved. However, I would note that the county mental health agency in most of our providers are the our county mental health agencies, except Multnomah County, who subcontracts, but the county mental health agency, which obviously is an agent of that very government, county government, is aware and obviously makes the determination that the individual is appropriate and is willing to accept them. So the same in Washington County, that Washington County, the county mental health agency would be obviously made aware and provided that copy of the conditional release order on each individual in that county.
Madam Chair, if I can comment, it just seems, one of the issues is communication. Mm-hmm. And apparently there's not a law prohibiting this conversation to occur. And why can't we fix that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Mao, we have no objection to entering into it. As a matter of fact, prior to this, we have been having discussions of how we can improve that communication line.
I have a thought from that, and I've lost it. I guess following up on the situation that we heard about Matthew Shipley. So one of the concerns in my Ogmald neighborhood in Milwaukee when the house was going to be sited there was that in that school district, the children walk to school. And so people were concerned that there were going to be people like Matthew Shipley placed in this facility when children would be walking by that house to school. So it would seem to me, I guess following up on what you're saying and what other people have brought up about at least notifying the community if a sexual predator is going to be placed in a convicted sexual predator is going to be placed in a community aside from somebody that would be in PSRB, the community would be notified, right? So why wouldn't the community be notified in this situation that they're going to be placed in that housing?
Madam Chair, not all sex offenders, even in DOC, require community notification.
And DOC,
I'm sorry, get my quarter. the Department of Corrections, there's a level system, is my understanding. When that was taken up by the legislature a number of years ago, there was a specific policy decision made to exclude PSRB clients from the community notification based on the fact that the board does, number one, because it's so difficult to place our clients, but secondly, because of the provisions that the board provides in terms of security, monitoring, and supervision. However, our clients do register, as do other sex offenders, and so law enforcement in each community in which our clients reside do know that our clients are where they live, and that the sex offenders are registered in that particular community. I will also tell you that any individual that's placed on conditional release, the board has a law enforcement data system terminal in our office, and every individual that's placed on conditional release, their name, their address, the charge for which they are placed under the board, as well as the name of their case manager and the phone number for both their case manager and the board staff, is entered into the law enforcement data system terminal. And if they have any contact, if they run our clients' names, it will show up immediately that they are a client of the PSRB and, for what offense they've been placed under the board.
So if Matthew Shipley were placed in that home, mm-hmm. there in Milwaukee,
the law enforcement would have been notified that this is a sexual predator. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Mr. Shipley was appropriately registered with the state police as a sex offender as required by law. And that was done as he was leaving the Oregon State Hospital before he even arrived in that city, is my understanding. That is the practice of the Oregon State Hospital staff, and they provide us with a document that indicates that they have taken them and had them registered.
So maybe I've lost something here, missed something. So he is in the community? Mr. Shipley is in the community?
Madam Chair, yes. He was conditionally released to a secure residential treatment facility in Cornelius, a new facility called the Connell House, to which those individuals referred, which is a fenced, it has a fenced perimeter and has locks that only can be buzzed in by staff, and has windows that cannot open. So it is as secure, you know, a facility that we have in a community setting.
And he is still there?
He is.
And he hasn't reoffended?
No.
How long has he been there?
I believe the facility opened in August, if my recollection is correct. I will also tell you that a condition of the release of those individuals who go to a secure environment is that they may not leave the facility without staff supervision, unless and until they make a request of the board, and that condition is modified. So as of right now, none of the individuals under the PSRB in that secure environment, or in our other secure environments, frankly, leave that facility without staff with them.
And the law enforcement in that community has been notified that he is there, right?
Yes,
because
they are
a sexual predator. Thank you. Representative Sterling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When the previous panel was up, I got the feeling that part of the information was lost in the testimony from the detective, with all due respect, because he was telling us several things, and so I was concerned that we didn't understand the complete story there. It also was a reference to the chief of police there, and are we having other witnesses?
No.
Because the chief is in the room.
I know. We have several people who would like to testify. We're just not going to have time for that.
Do we entertain written testimony?
Sure, and we've got written testimony that we'll be handing out. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Come on.
As I'm listening, I'm just wondering, the notification question seems to keep cropping up. Mm-hmm. Is there perhaps a breakdown here? I believe you said that the notification went to Oregon State Police, that someone has been released who might be classified as a sexual offender. Is that correct?
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, that's the protocol. That's the Oregon State Police protocol.
Right.
The
okay.
Sex offender registration happens through the Oregon State Police, but then is entered into the law enforcement data system that is available to all law enforcement personnel, be it a local sheriff or a city chief or whoever.
So it's available, mm-hmm. but there's not a specific notification made directly to the local law enforcement. So maybe there's just a matter of, see what I'm saying? It goes into a database, but there may not be a direct line of communication to the local law enforcement. They would sort of have to check that periodically or something in order to be aware. Is that fair?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, that may well be.
I think that's where part of the confusion was around notification. So I just thought I'd try to get that clarified.
But and why wouldn't you notify the local
exactly.
police instead of just the state police?
Madam Chair, this just has never been, they've never requested it. It's never come up prior to the recent situation, to be perfectly frank. Nobody has ever...
Which situation are you referring to?
In the Washington County.
Okay.
You know, any time we've had discussions, as I said, we've had discussions in cities and communities where we've developed homes, and we've had particular conversations with local police chiefs or what have you, but it hasn't been done on a standardized basis. For example, as I said, we had the conversations with the Woodburn police chief. I spoke to the police chief in Hermiston the other day. She toured and got the lay of the land and the security provisions for that facility, but it's been done on a case-by-case basis. There's never
been... Do you need new legislation to be able to do that?
Chair Tomei, I'm not sure. I think we've been having, conversations as to decide what the best way to handle that, and we, I believe the governor's office and AMH and Addictions and Mental Health Division and the PSRB are going to pursue that with the law enforcement officials, is my understanding.
This committee would like to be involved in that, too. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Representative Cowan, I know you weren't finished.
Thank you. I'm just trying to get clarity here. So I'd like to back up to one other thing, too, that we had talked about when we had some considerable testimony about potential revocation of PSRB, I can say that right, clients, based on reoffending. Mm-hmm. And then we had additional testimony about the standard for recidivism and what could or couldn't be included. So could you clarify, when you say reoffending, do you mean something that classifies as recidivism, or do you mean what many of us, I think, would consider an offense is an offense, and we don't get into which statute, which standard it might be?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, Mr. Herman was correct that our recidivism rate refers to felony, the commission of a felony, okay, and does not include misdemeanors. However, it's not quite the same as corrections. It's the closest we could for a comparative analysis, but it's not convicted of a felony of offense, nor do we do it within the three, Department of Corrections uses within 3 years. We do it at any time. So ours are actually more restrictive, but it would be being arrested for a felony offense at any time while on conditional release.
Thank you.
However, if this committee were to desire, I could get the numbers for persons with regard to misdemeanor offenses. Those people are usually subject to immediate revocation. They just wouldn't be considered under that performance measure of a commission of a felony, the recidivism one, but they would be subject to a revocation process and often return to the hospital if that was appropriate. But I could get you the numbers if this committee would so desire. We can run our data and see how many were revoked as a result of a misdemeanor as well.
In response, I should think that the committee would be interested, in light of the kind of conversation we're having, about revocations and basically committing or being arrested for offenses that the community considers a crime.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I know we have the chief of police from Cornelius. Is that, sir? I'm going to call you up for this panel. In the meantime, I know you have a question for me.
Madam Chair, it just seems to me that some of the issues we're talking about are probably judiciary issues and not human services. And so are they rolled into this conversation somehow?
They aren't as yet, but they will be.
They will be?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Senior issues go to rules. Judiciary comes to human service.
This
is new. You don't understand the process.
But I don't know where that line is drawn.
Right. That is not my intent to deal with legal issues. I think what my intent is to get a full picture of what is happening, so that when we're dealing with mental health issues and we go to the community, we have some knowledge of what these issues are. Yes.
If I can clarify, I think Bob and Mary Claire will clarify as well, that this PSRB mental health issue goes back and forth from judiciary to human service committees pretty much constantly. So they are very much aware on the judiciary front of maybe not this particular issue that you bring today, but of the whole PSRB mental health relationship. participate there. They check it quite often.
Okay. Representative Cowan, you were through?
I think so.
Okay. Representative
Cortez. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just in addition to the numbers that we were talking about, maybe flow charts of the notification processes, because that might be helpful if you have something like that, that when this happens, we contact these folks. And okay. That would help us. Thank you.
Here, Representative Cortez. Well,
we'd like you to stay, if you would, please, sure. And we'll hear from the police chief.
Madam Chair, my name is Paul Rubenstein. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Cornelius. I've been a law enforcement officer for 30 years. During that time period, I also sat on the board of directors of Banyan Tree, Inc., which is a mental health transitional housing to move people into the community. I am sensitive to this issue. I'm going to keep my comments, I guess, directed towards your notification side. I have a lot of others, but that's where I'll stay. I was notified about this community facility being built as a member of the design review, but it was, and I won't go into a lot of detail because we're still in process as a community, we were not notified there'd be PSRB clients. I was pro the concept of another facility of this particular mental health contractor because my experience with them is they're a very professional organization. My opinion of them has not changed, but this facility is different from their other facilities. Towards the end of August, I received a letter from the District Attorney Bob Herman that Mr. Matthew Shipley was in my community at this facility. This was of concern to me because I had no prior notification at all. Law enforcement is aware of the registered sex offenders. I monitor them closely. In hindsight, I can tell you what happened. He, in fact, did register the day he left the state mental hospital. It was not entered, and I was calling and calling for it. Did not enter for 30 days.
Enter what?
Into the system that we have access to. There was no way for me to know he had been even entered into the registered sex offender system. The other registered sex offenders took even longer, 6 weeks. Mr. Shipley, were he a DOC, Department of Corrections client, would automatically, based on the nature of his crime, be classified as a predator. I was concerned. I'd received no notice from our mental health community that this facility, which is a much more secure facility, existed in our community. We had all sorts of building code issues and security, which we can talk about later. I contacted the mental health contractor, explained what my concerns were, aside from the existence of the facility. I met with them in an attempt to work out some of these issues. I asked who's here. The only way I found out who was in the facility was Sheriff Gordon filed a Freedom of Information Act, which that resulted in the PSRB providing me with solely the copies of their conditional releases. And to date, that is all I have received on who's in that facility. Now, my job isn't to determine where those things go. You could build a hospital, a jail, a state mental hospital in any community. My issue is go through the appropriate process, do the appropriate public notification. I was concerned enough with Mr. Shipley that I considered doing a public notification myself. Now, under Department of Correction rules, had he been one of their clients, I could have done it immediately. Ms. Buckley made it very clear to me, if I did so, I'd be violating law. So I do have a career. I called the Attorney General's office and said, what is the law? The Attorney General's office informed me they would not inform me as to the law, as they could view it as a conflict of interest because they have to represent the PSRB. You should contact your local counsel. My local counsel says the law is too vague. They can't give me an answer. To date, nobody has said anything about what my legal obligations are. But there is a current Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling holding local law enforcement liable for the failure to notify their community if they had knowledge on a DOC client. It makes me nervous. Because I was not notified in advance and didn't go through the process of the facility, it was open in operation for 1 month. During that 1 month, had they called 911, we'd have arrived and could not get in. They had a fence with codes that worked only for those people that worked in there. We couldn't, emergency services couldn't get in. Nobody could get in. So if they had an emergency where no one could meet us at the gate, we'd have to force our way in through a fence, through locked doors. Then when I read the conditional release under PSRB regulations, Mr. Shipley, for example, is required to have at all times two people in the facility while he's there. They were walking him around in the community in a group of seven with two people, saying, well, that's okay. Yet all of these people together could be controlled by the same two people. We had questions about the security. Now, the mental health contractor and I sat down and talked, and I said, before I decide whether I'm going to jeopardize my career by going public, convince me, show me that this person is appropriately housed and that this security works. They set up an appointment. They made it very clear they were going to talk to me. I showed up for the appointment, and I was informed by them that they were informed by the PSRB they couldn't talk to me.
Okay.
So they don't. The reason Mr. Shipley is not contacted is because he doesn't walk out in my community. They transport him to another city. And they walk him around. They've agreed to do it on a one-to-one relationship with the PSRB clients. Local law enforcement would determine somebody was under the jurisdiction of the PSRB if they contacted them and ran them. But if we're contacting one of their clients and running them, it's already gone way too far because they've escaped.
Thank you, Mr. Rubenstein. It seems you have a lot to tell us, and what I'd invite you to do is, if you wouldn't mind, to put this in writing so we can give it to the whole.
I would just ask that prior to the building of the facility and the opening, that they be required to contact local law enforcement and work out the security features and tell us who's there in advance so that we can work this out and respond appropriately.
Thank you. Colleagues and everybody who's attended today, and especially for Bob and Mary Claire, the purpose of this meeting was to help facilitate folks coming back into the community, and it looks like we've opened up a can of worms here that a lot of it I wasn't aware of, and I hope that we can work toward this. Obviously, we're not going to do it all today, but it's something that this committee will be working on. I'd like to hear more about this in February and on through the interim and into next session. It seems that we have a lot of questions, but this is just beginning to open up the door, I think, to providing the answers to all of that. So if you, I know Representative Cowan has to leave soon, and be delighted to hear if you have anything more to say.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd just like to thank the committee for the interest in the issues, and you know, it's our intent to try to figure these things out. If there are statutory changes that can and should be made, we want to be at the table and talk about those so that we air any concerns that we have out. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mayor. I would just echo Mr. Nichols. You know, the PSRB is more than willing to work with its partners. It's clearly critical that we develop these community facilities so that our clients can move back in, and whatever it takes to do so, we'd be happy to do.
And the message I was getting in my community was the only population that they had trouble with were the PSRB clients. So I would imagine that's not isolated to Milwaukee. I'm sure it's throughout the state that people are concerned.
Unfortunately, so.
Yeah, and I know what a difficult position that puts you and everybody else who works in the system. And there's also certainly the issue about of it I'm trying to find. We need to obviously deal with public safety, but we also need to deal with issues of privacy.
Mm-hmm. Confidentiality.
Confidentiality. Thank you, Mary. So I'm hoping that we can work with the whole group of people, from the police office to the district attorneys to the providers to people in the street, working with the legislature to come up with some answers. Yes, it's Tim Gilliam.
Madam Chair, this is I'm very appreciative that you brought this to our attention. I've learned a great deal today, so I'm so grateful that you're having our committee look at it. Because we're in a strange situation in February, we obviously are not going to address this in February, and we're looking rightfully towards policy changes for 09. But I have to make this observation that in the meantime, if it is legal under your policies and the law relating to your area to notify police agencies, if there's anything you can do to improve communication with local law enforcement, and on the other end, if there's anything you can do, if we're already letting the state police know, if there's anything you can do to get that information that's already there, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to put this on you, but to get it from the state police, to me, that was the one communications piece. I'm not talking about a larger legislative piece that we can improve, and I want to urge you to do that, because for me, my observation up here was that was, in this case, a piece that was missing. Anything we can do to initiate that would improve communication.
And I've got one last question to ask you, Bob, referring to the letter that John Foote gave us that you had addressed to him. So could you, maybe we don't have time here, and if you want to address it at length later, that would be fine too. But it seems that the length of time that people are staying in the state hospital has decreased over time for PSRB or violent, what was it, manslaughter, homicide, rape, and sexual abuse. The people are suffering who've committed those crimes are spending less time both in the state hospital and under PSRB. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's my recollection. My letter will speak for itself, but I can't speak for whether they spend less time under the overall jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I don't think that has changed, but I would also encourage looking at whether there's any relationship between revocations and commission of new crimes with these changes in length of stay. And from the data that I've got in front of me, I don't see any change in those critical indicators. But
and you'll get that information to us so we can know that. That would be great. Anything else? Anything from the committee? Thank you all very, very much. This was very informative.
Thank you.
Oh, there's a letter, colleagues, before I... from Representative Flores. Has that been distributed yet? Okay, she will distribute it. Issues that she's concerned about. So I will close the informational hearing of the House Interim Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. Thank you all very much. Have a great holiday.